It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy, Alex, Jason, we're all together today to talk about Apple's incredible quarter and why it might not be such a great quarter last week. I'm just excited that Macs sold really well. They won't be selling new Macs this year, though. Tim Cook gave us a hint. And Amazon Prime and its new music. Could it be a threat to Apple Music? All that coming up in just a bit with Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 842, recorded Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. You've been spatialized. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes it easy to hire for even the most specific role, like, say, a mascot in Missouri. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers find a quality candidate within the first day. Try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And by Adigy, the only Apple device management platform that combines MDM with live agent capabilities to manage and secure your Apple ecosystem, regardless of your Macspertise. Visit adigy.com/twit for a free 14-day trial to see how Adigy helps you manage your Apple devices in real time, because IT problems can't wait. And by CashFly. Deliver your video on the network with the best throughput and global reach, making your content infinitely scalable. Go live in hours, not days. Learn more at cashfly.com. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. And I came in this morning thinking there was no news. Boy, was I wrong, because we've got charts. Jason Snell is here from sixcolors.com.
I pity that sucker who has to bake all those financial charts about all the money Apple made.
Oh, it's me. It's you.
It's self-pity after all. Well, it's good to be here and talk about. I made the charts. I might as well talk about.
Do you use all six colors in the charts?
I try to. I don't always get to them. I've got like colors mapped to the different categories. So like there's a color for services and a color for wearables and Mac. And I guess there's one color left for another category. So Apple.
There's a free color, kids. Apple, you're not, you're underachieving. That's that chuckle is Mr. Andy Inako from WGBH in Baston. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Leo.
Good to see you. Welcome.
Always.
He is entering the winter months in his fortress of solitude.
Indeed. This is where we kind of stop telling the outsiders this. You're not cold. This is just crisp. And we're starting, yeah, you know what? Maybe it's time to get that bucket of road salt and have it by the front door.
And Mr. Alex Lindsay from 090.media and officehours.global. He's already done more this morning than most of us do in an entire week.
It's up, by the way.
Your
interview.
Oh, I didn't know it would be that fast.
We're that fast.
Should I tweet it or toot
sure.
it?
Yeah. Don't toot it. Tweet it. Tweet it.
Don't toot it. Tweet it.
Yeah. So
where is it up? At graymatter.com?
Graymatter.show.
.show.
Great. Graymatter.show.
And this is the interview I did last week, last Friday. Wow, that was fast.
Boom.
Season 1, episode 13. Access the podcast. The Shifting Sands.
It was great. Great interview.
I will now copy this and send it over to Elon for approval. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for your service. This is the graph. Total Apple revenue. $90 billion. It's a record quarter for the third quarter, fourth calendar quarter.
Q4. It is once again a record for Apple. It is the most boring and yet impressive run of the company that you think couldn't possibly generate more cash continuing to generate more cash every single quarter, even with the, I mean, if you want to talk about foreign exchange headwinds, boy, can I tell you a story about it. But basically, even though the a lot of the places where Apple is charging for products, the dollar is so strong that it makes their profit from there and their revenue from there diluted because the dollar is so strong, they still manage somehow to put up $90 billion in revenue. So yeah, it's
amazing.
You know, it's a machine that generates money at this point. That's what it is.
83.4 this year. Last time, 64.7 this year. 2 years ago, this time 2 years ago. I mean, it is a record. Also, it's the end of their year, their fiscal year. So we also get was it a good year?
Of course. Yeah, I mean,
it was a very
big surprise. It was a very good year for Macs and maybe everything else except iPads. iPad is kind of flat, but yeah, I mean, it is. I got to put up my charts for the annuals now that the year is closed, but it's the same story, which is up. Apple is so much more, you know, a cash generating company than it was. The rise in the 2010s really is the breathtaking thing, and they continue doing that, and that's the most impressive thing. Is
28.7 billion profit in the last three months.
And it's funny because their CFO keeps talking about how they want to go cash neutral. Because remember, there was a point where they had more than $100 billion in cash, like stuffed in mattresses somewhere. $100 billion with a B. And it's like it's like almost Sisyphean, or like, remember Brewster's Millions, that movie where a guy had to try to give away $1 million and he couldn't.
It's
a little like Luke. This is Maestri's billions.
He should have bought Twitter. They should have bought Twitter. They could have got it cheap. $100 billion in profit this year.
Five years they've been trying, at least 5 years, to reduce their cash position, and they still have almost $50 billion in cash. So, like, they can't give it away. They buy back stock. They do dividends.
Yeah.
And they acquire, apparently, a company a month they're acquiring, and still they just can't get rid of all this cash.
Year over year total revenue change 8%.
Well, and I think that the thing that's interesting is a lot of people say, well, the shareholders are getting all this money back, but those shareholders, a lot of them are employees. So we have to remember a lot of the employees almost all the employees, or all the employees, I think, if they're actually an employee of Apple, are getting some version of stocks. And so these are, by pushing that, by providing dividends as well as buybacks, those are all increasing value for their employees in addition to the shareholders.
Would you rather, as a shareholder, have dividends? A buyback increases the value of your stock because there are fewer shares.
Right.
Would you rather have dividends or buybacks? It's good for the company to have buybacks.
I think they do both, specifically because some people would like to get money back. Like,
dividends are cash
money
in your pocket.
You literally get cash in your pocket, exactly. Yeah. Whereas
it's also,
the buybacks are just driving the stock upward, theoretically.
Right.
And it's also a taxable event, I believe, dividends are.
Ah, so that's the other side of that.
Yeah, so that's
money's always a taxable event when you get it. The problem is you don't get it when you sell the stock. A dividend you get. Yeah.
Right.
11.5 billion Mac revenue. It looks like in all the quarters you've gotten this graph, it's the best Mac quarter ever.
It's the best Mac quarter ever, and three out of the last four out of the last five, depending on how you want to count it, you could actually say that seven out of the last nine quarters are the best best seven Mac quarters ever. I actually think maybe it's even true that, like, the last nine quarters are the nine best Mac quarters ever. The Mac has never generated as much revenue as it is now.
I'm glad to hear that.
And it's weird because sequentially it's way up from last quarter. But the reason that Apple went into, if you remember back to this, like, late spring, early summer, where we were all trying to buy Macs, like Mac Studios, and they were a 3 month delay.
Yeah.
Basically, all their factories that assemble Macs are in Shanghai, and they shut down, and they spent most of last quarter behind, and so they didn't sell very many Macs last quarter because they couldn't get them.
In fact,
so
revenue last quarter was down 10% year over year. But it was up 25% this year.
They fulfilled all those orders, fulfilled a quarter's worth of orders, and filled the channel with Macs, you know, to go on store shelves or be at Amazon or wherever. And that's part of the reason it was up so much this time, is that they were really kind of fulfilling all the demand that they weren't being able to meet last quarter.
But it does. I mean, especially if you just look at this graph, where this is the dividing point. It's obvious that the silicon has been a huge, huge boon for Apple. And in the PC side, Intel and Qualcomm are still struggling to do anything like the efficiency of this Apple Silicon. It really is a success.
And the problem is it's really hard to do if you're not Apple. So Apple has now really forced people to play a game that only it can really play, which is that they own the IDE, they own the operating system, they own the hardware, and by doing that, it allows you to integrate a bunch of pieces that everybody else has to find their way to a consortium. They have to all agree on it. So you have all these different companies with all these different ideas of how they want to run it, and they have to all agree to build something that looks like an M1 or an M2. And that is incredibly difficult.
I would put it, it's a walled garden all the way down.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's
ecosystem everywhere.
If they bought the plants that made the chips, you know,
that's the one thing they don't. But, you know, in a way, they kind of own TSMC. Yeah. I mean, they certainly they're tightly bound at the hip. iPad revenue kind of flat. Not so good.
I think it's hard to prove that you need a new one.
That's an example of something that's too good.
Well, I don't think that we're seeing very many apps. And this is the problem that PCs have, is that Excel runs as fast as it's ever going to run. You know, and so there's just a lot of people that only use a basic version. That there's a lot of PCs out there, but they're not all being used in a creative area that really pushes the envelope. And so there's not many times when you feel like you hit the top end of your iPad with the apps that are out there. And I think that's a real challenge, is to encourage and this would be hard for Apple to do, but I do think that, like, what Epic has done with the mega grants is genius, you know, which is that we want to see people push the envelope out. And so we're going to, you know, we have a fund to give you money to develop certain kinds of things. So if Apple was pushing to, you know, we're looking for things that are really going to push the performance of the iPad. Any dollar they put into that would probably push, would make $10 on the other end, because it would drive people to buy new iPads because there's a really cool app that really uses it. But we don't see much of that at all.
Apple historically doesn't do stuff like that. But boy, if you're trying to get rid of some of that cash, Luca, hand it off, you know. You see every creator space, like YouTube and TikTok and Facebook, all have creator funds where they give money. Epic, that's interesting that Epic does that for developers to use.
The mega grant is really probably one of the best ones out there, because if there's no strings attached, if they give you the money, the funny thing is, if it's basically talking to people about it that have gotten some of them, if it's under $25,000, they don't really need to see anything. Like, they just need to think it's a good idea.
Just have some money.
Like, they're not, they said, if it's over $25,000, you probably need to give us a business plan.
Yeah.
Like, what you might do with this. But if it's under $25,000, you know, like, this looks like it. And what they're doing is they really are engaging. Before the troubles with Apple, all of us, you know, were just paying. We were like, oh, it might be Unity or Unreal. And then as soon as the Epic grants came in, everyone went Unreal. And then when Epic got into the fight with Apple, everyone's like, well, we don't know yet. And so they really, that's why I always feel like that was such an unforced error.
So you think Apple should do the same with pro apps on the tablet, on iOS?
High performance apps, I would say, you know, pros in different ways. I mean, in science, in media,
You could drive iPad sales by having those apps available.
That are really taking full advantage of the hardware, which I just don't see anything out there pushing. I mean, LumaFusion pushes it pretty hard, you know, is a good example of something that is using up that iPad for all it's worth. But there's not that many apps out there that do that.
Well, I think the other consideration here is that a lot of the background information that was given in the actual earnings call had to do with not necessarily, oh, well, we're getting a lot of people switching from unprecedented year for people switching from Android to iPhone, unprecedented number of new Mac users, unprecedented new sales of blah, 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 less because of our products are wonderful, are superior. People are getting onto it. People are really excited about it. And a lot of the stuff that's in the call actually explains that there are extenuating circumstances. For instance, what Jason was saying earlier, that one of the reasons for such a stellar year for Macs and iPhones is the pent up demand. There was a lot of opportunities that they missed this quarter last year because of supply constraints and not simply being able to manufacture enough of them. So a lot of the people who didn't buy last year where had that money still under the mattress and were ready to buy next year. And also there's the I think two or three times they mentioned how well they're doing in Mexico, India, Vietnam, and a couple other countries that they typically don't really talk about. So we have a lot of people who are essentially new money coming into the iPhone market. Not that they've never sold there before, but now that they're really, really being, now that they're Apple is being more aggressive towards making sure that they're selling to everybody who wants an iPhone in the world, no matter where they are. You get a lot more people switching from Android because those are going to be certainly Android's strongholds. So there's a lot of subtext here that comes down to not just the iPad needs to have more professional apps, or the strategy is this, or people aren't really responding to that. But a lot has to do with simply that this is the cadence of how people buy things and why certain valves are open and certain other valves are kind of more loose and tight.
Do we know how well the iPad does internationally? Is it a U.S. phenomenon?
They have said that it has done, that they've seen a lot of growth with the iPad outside of the U.S. I think what happened is that in the U.S. and maybe Europe, the iPad had that huge spike 2012, 2013, where they made a huge amount of money and everybody thought, oh, well, here we go, rocket ship going up. And then it didn't. And it's only been since sort of 2019 where the sales have gone back up. And I just, to put the iPad number in context, they did sell $29 billion worth of iPads in, in fiscal 22. It is essentially at the height it was in 2012, 2013. It's down a couple billion from last year, which I think you could really see people buying iPads in pandemic lockdowns and things like that. But like, I know that everybody's focused on growth. I get it. But if the iPad's disappointment is that it's settled in as a $30 billion-ish a year business, the iPad's doing okay. It's not taking over the world. There's no doubt about it. It's not reaching the heights that the Mac has been reaching lately. And yet it has come from those years in the doldrums where it was down in the teens back up to around $30 billion a year. Pretty, just by Apple standards, it's kind of an okay business, but I think by most standards, it's doing pretty well.
Yeah. Also, you really have to compare the tone of this call with all the other calls that a lot of us have been reading for the past week and a half, where like you have Facebook's, which is like,
We lost half our value over the past year.
And basically Captain Queeg is going to be chasing that white whale all the way down to the bottom of the ocean. Google saying we did well, we didn't grow as much as we wanted to, but here are reasons why the investments that we're making in the future are positive investments. We are very aware of the challenges that face us, and we're addressing them. Whereas Apple is, we made a fortune. We would have made a little bit more of a fortune had it not been for A, B, and C. And by the way, please, we're not going to be this successful every quarter. I mean, that was almost a direct quote. Like, we are not going to have a record quarter every quarter. Come on. I mean, there, even Lewis Hamilton sometimes doesn't win the F1. Come on. The whole upbeat tone of this thing, especially when you have lots of things to be upbeat about, it really is interesting compared to every other call that we've been reading and listening to for the past week or two.
Captain, by the way, it was Ahab who chased the white whale. Captain Queeg was looking for the strawberry ice cream in the freezer. It was gone. It was disappeared.
In my defense, either one of them would be a better CEO instead of Facebook than
I know I do charts, but I don't normally watch financial television. But right before the Apple results come out, I like to turn on CNBC and see what they're saying. Yeah. And they were pulling their hair out. I mean, they're like, oh, God, tech industry, it's destroyed. Apple's going to destroy it further. Then there's the one guy who's like, no, I'm bullish on Apple. Apple will save us. And that guy always does that. And he's always right, at least so far. But the doom and gloom, I hadn't really realized how much financial people were like looking at the tech industry as a crater, a smoking crater, right? And then you come in and Apple strolls in the door, and it is not as if Apple is without blemish. They have lots of things that you can look at and be skeptical about in the, like, if you analyze it. But compared to the rest of the tech industry, oh my goodness. Yeah.
Philip Elmer DeWitt was on Twit on Sunday, and he pointed out the graph that he had borrowed from the Wall Street Journal. That shows how the tech industry has done in the last month. And the Meta is at the bottom there. Look at that. Look at that drop right there. Amazon next. Look at that drop right there. Alphabet next. Look at Apple. Hey, wait a minute. But, and I pointed out, and you know, it's funny, the market has some, and investors have so little memory. A lot of this drop was because of a big spike in COVID. And we went back and looked at share prices pre-COVID and today. In almost every respect, all the tech companies are up versus January 2020. So it really was that they just had an unusual, and it, you brought this up earlier, Jason. They had a big bump in during COVID, and now they're coming off of that a little bit, and there's some shrinkage. Oh,
and if you're focused on growth, it's hard. Right. Like they have a term, and all this jargon that I've gotten to learn covering this, it's called the tough compare. But what does it mean? What it means is if you're focused on growth and you're looking at year over year, what did they do in the year ago quarter versus now? And then you have a big COVID bump where people are like buying laptops because they have to work at home, and they're buying iPads and for their kid for school and all that stuff. Well, that's great, right? The sales go way up. But in the back of your mind, if you're Luca Maestri and Tim Cook, you're thinking, how are we going to beat this next year
exactly.
when we sold all these this year? And that's, I think, maybe the real levitation that Apple's done is they managed to sort of maintain up there because, it's just year over year compare. If you have a big spike, you're going to take it in the chin the next year because you can't.
But remember,
it's very hard to match.
This is the mismatch between investors' priorities and what should be a company's priorities. Investors only care about how their stock did over the last quarter. Companies raked in trillions of dollars in windfall profits over the last 2 years, all of them. And I think to some degree companies would like to pretend that didn't happen because they don't really want people to think about how much money they made while the rest of us were suffering. Yeah, Alex?
Well, I think that the other thing is that Apple, you know, what Apple's done is almost impossible. Like, and it, you know, being able to build a vertical market at this level of your phone and your wearables and everything all integrated together, they own the OS and the hardware and all those other bits and pieces. It's an almost impossible thing to do, but once you get to the other side, it's almost impossible to compete with because you have we're looking at good Mac numbers, but they're still 10% of the market. You know, they have 90% in front of them, you know, to take.
Well, that was another question I was asking on Sunday was has Apple saturated the market? And everybody said no. God, no, not even
not
close.
Only,
but
not
it
only,
may be in the U.S., but internationally, there's a lot of growth potential.
Yeah. Well, but also, they haven't even saturated in the accessories. You know, HomeKit is a good example. HomeKit's a disaster. If Apple decided that they just gave up on this HomeKit program and said we're just going to make a thermostat, a lock, of outlet,
totally
they would totally double that little they would have a little sliver in there that's 10% of the revenue. That's all those things, and at some point I think they're just going to give up because the home automation industry just won't commit to Apple, and so at some point Apple has to just say, well, you know, we're just going to have to do it ourselves. And if they do that and they do those five things are like 90% of the market, right?
I don't understand that statement. What do you mean they won't commit to Apple?
They're doing HomeKit, but they're not doing exclusively HomeKit. They want to be in Zigbee something else. And so they have all the stuff.
Well,
they have
also
all the stuff.
Matter. You know what? The home automation is a mess. It's still a mess.
But it's a mess. Yeah. And there's a whole bunch of us like me that are just sitting on the outside waiting for Apple to just start releasing products. Because the thing is that it's like, it's never really going to, you open up the stuff that's home. I buy HomeKit stuff as a test and it never really works, you know, and it's supposed to just work and it never does. And Apple, you know, was heavy handed at the very beginning. People didn't commit to it. Apple then loosened it up, and now there's more things, but none of them work.
Apple made it very expensive.
It's November 1st. This is theoretically, I think, basically day one of Matter. And I think with the next OS updates, you're going to see a lot of this, and a lot of this home stuff is going to resolve, because they all put down their, I mean, it was years ago. It was like 3 years ago. They put down their swords and said, we're going to stop fighting. We're going to make one standard. Now they have to roll it out, and that's going to be a little painful. But I feel like that war is already over and starting soon.
What I will say is
we're not going to have to deal with it.
That absolutely would have been death if everybody started saying, we're going to make this light bulb that works great with Google, and then we have another light bulb that works great with Apple. That, how about people who don't necessarily are not willing to go all in on one platform? You should be able to buy one light bulb. And actually, I will lay most of the blame at Apple's feet on this one, because I have a mixed hardware here in the house. I do have some HomeKits. I do have Apples that work with HomeKit. I have Google stuff. I've got Nest stuff. I've got Philips Hue stuff and hubs. The only one that gets screwed up is HomeKit, and that's not everyone else's responsibility. That's Apple's responsibility.
Well, again, I would argue that there's an awful lot, billions worth of cash of people who would just buy from Apple if Apple delivered it. Like, you know, like they would just be like, I don't care if it works with everything else. All I want to do is work with my Mac.
Don't you have a problem because there are a lot of people who tried over the last decade home automation, and it ended up being janky, didn't work so well. It was interoperable. I think the mass of people who've tried it are just said, oh, I'm not going to do that.
Again,
but do you think they'll come back if somebody came along and made it easy?
If
Apple did it, yeah.
Like it's not. We'll see. If Matter works. I'm so beaten up by it.
Yeah.
I get what Alex is saying about, like, I want Apple to do it. Apple's not going to make every home product you want. They seem to just have decided they're not going to. But what you're going to get is, under the auspices of Apple and Google and Microsoft, you're going to get this Matter stuff where Apple, and it's going to be in the Apple Store, and Apple's going to say, this is our blessed way we do this now. But it's not, if you're looking for Apple to make a router and a lock and a light bulb, they're not going to do it.
Amazon's going to. In fact, Ring just announced they're doing car alarms now.
Yeah.
Amazon is exactly the kind of company that's willing to make a lot of cheap and consumer products.
And if it's a Matter device, it won't be walled off from people who are using the Google Assistant or are using HomeKit.
Right. And I just think if it doesn't work, I think Apple will have to do it. We'll see. I've been trying to automate. I've been playing with automation in my houses for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's been a disaster for 2 decades.
It's awful.
Like, it is just an unmitigated disaster. Yeah.
I'm going to push back a little bit, because you're looking for Apple to save you, and the Home app has been terrible for years, and it's only now slightly less terrible, although automation in the Home app is still kind of a disaster. So Apple needs to get its own house in order first, right? Like, I need to properly automate things in the Home app, and they just haven't done. Like, there's a weird implementation of shortcuts in there, except it's very limited and it doesn't work right. And I don't know. Apple has a lot of work to do with what they've got to make it better.
They only get away with that because everybody else is awful as well, right?
It helps.
I would say less awful, but yeah.
I have some questions about this market and you know, they're just channeling Steve Jobs, who said you got to say no to almost everything, right? Apple's gotten a little looser on that. Look at all the different iPad SKUs, but I think there's 48. Somebody counted 48 iPad SKUs now.
Yeah.
I want to take a little break. We'll come back. I want to talk about the future, too, because Apple was not quite so sanguine about the next quarter. Also, services. But first, a word from our sponsor. Are you hiring, first of all? One, yay, thank you. Number two, are you hiring somebody who needs to wear many hats? Or maybe you're hiring for a simple role, but it's taking forever to find someone who's a great fit. Finding someone to wear many hats or one very specific hat, no easy task. It wasn't even easy for me to say that. Whether you're hiring a civil engineer in New York, a pediatric nurse in Nebraska, an attorney in Colorado, or even a mascot in Missouri, ZipRecruiter helps you find qualified candidates fast. It's what we use. And it's been a great, great boon for us. Whenever we're down a member, and it happens, you know, people move on, they move, they retire. We go immediately to ZipRecruiter because we know, A, it's going to be easy. B, it's going to give us the best chance of hiring exactly the right person. And C, it's easy. And Lisa needs easy. ZipRecruiter helps you find qualified candidates fast, from accountant to zoologist and everything in between. ZipRecruiter's matching technology, this is the one of the cool things they do. They do many cool things. It's really awesome. As soon as you post your job, they look at your qualifications, your requirements, and then they find people in their vast database of current resumes, and they introduce them to you so you could decide whether you want to hire them. And I have to tell you, when you invite somebody to apply to your job, they respond. You can invite your top choices to apply with a click. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I'm thinking back to all the times we've done it, and I think we get it within the first hour or two. I mean, it's really fantastic. And some of our best staffers have come via ZipRecruiter. Try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. Please use that address so they know you heard it here. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Thank you, ZipRecruiter, for supporting our show. Services have been down the last 2 quarters. This was one of the shining stars in Apple's quarterly results. I mean, it's not like they're down a lot, but is there something to worry about?
Down sequentially, still up year over year. This is the one case where I think Apple's excuse that they are getting hammered by foreign exchange is actually accurate. If you do the math, like just having a strong dollar, you know, maybe you used to take in $6.50 a month from Apple TV subscriptions in the UK, and without changing the price, and they did change the price, they just raised the price.
Yeah, I just got my email. They're bumping me up $3 for my Apple One. Yeah.
Well, without changing the price, that $6.50 or whatever in the UK when you launched, now you're bringing in like $5.50 or $5.60, and that is happening all over the world, everywhere but the US. Is that the just the movement of the dollar against all the other currencies means that all that services revenue is devalued. They said that if you calculate their services revenue in local currency rather than taking the hit and converting it back to the dollar, they were up double digits.
Oh, that's interesting.
In services. Oh. So I think that this is one of those cases. But
and they can't raise prices, you know, too fast or they're going to scare people off. So.
Right. But they did raise prices on TV, and they raised it in music, but they blamed the record companies for that. But they did raise it in TV. I think it's interesting also that what we've seen outside of the U.S. and for everybody who watches and listens to this show outside of the U.S., I know we're very U.S. centric because we're here, but Apple's been repricing their products and new products that come out get priced way higher everywhere but the U.S. So we see these new products come out from Apple, and we're like, oh, that new iPad, it's the same price as the, you know, as the time before. That new iPhone is the same price as the time before. Not overseas, it's not. Like, yeah. In other countries, they are ratcheting up the prices.
I've actually heard people complaining about that a lot.
Yeah.
How expensive an iPhone has gotten. So maybe that is going to, that might hurt them.
It might, and yet they claim that they get so many people, as Andy mentioned, you know, so many people who are new to iPhone or new to iPad. So I think that they're still, you know, they're walking a line there where they want to have people buy their products and come to the product line. But at the same time, the strong dollar does hurt them, you know, to the tune of, they keep saying, you know, $4 or $5 billion a quarter that is just revenue that they would not, you know, that they can't really account for in U.S. dollars. Because the dollar is so strong.
Yeah. Let's continue on looking at the colorful charts, the lovely colorful charts. Wearables, pretty good, yeah? The home.
New AirPods and a new Apple Watch.
Yeah. So that was up a little bit. Year-over-year revenue up 10% after a bad quarter last quarter. Percentage revenue by product line. The iPhone is...
Just remember, the iPhone is important.
Is
the
really important. Is half of Apple's business. In fact, it's more... It's less important than it has been, right? Seasonal, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but that is a very seasonal thing if you look at the spike there where the iPhone is like next quarter, the holiday quarter, which is also the first full quarter that the new
You'll
iPhone
see another
for
one
sale,
of these dips.
It
like
will be
we
more
see
like
every
six,
4 quarters.
Yeah. It'll be more like 55% or 60% of Apple's revenue, whereas this time it was down in the 47-48% range. But
it
like,
is interesting.
Never forget,
it is interesting that services have become the second most
second biggest revenue producer.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, it is almost free money compared to hardware. So
right.
Oh, this is an amazing thing about it. We're looking at revenue, right? We're looking at pure revenue. One of the things they mention is the margin, the profit margin on this. And the profit margin on that services revenue is enormous. Yeah. They make so much profit on every dollar that comes in through services versus with hardware where they have to build the hardware and ship the hardware and deliver the hardware and maybe repair the hardware. The services, it's just sort of like
free money.
It's not quite free money, but it's close.
It's rent seeking, as many have pointed out.
Well, they do have to actually like pay the musical artists, or they have to make those expensive
most of it's
TV
from the app
shows
store,
and all
though,
of
right?
that.
Most of it's from
but,
the app store.
But on the app store, that is just cash to the bottom line.
Pure money.
They were also quick to point out how their growth in not just having people who are having services accounts, but number of paid accounts. They're saying that it was another record year for like actual paid numbers, more than 900 million paid subscriptions across the services on our platform, up more than 155 million during the last 12 months alone and doubled what we had just 3 years ago. Though I don't know that was another one where I kind of had a question mark on where does that include people who accepted your offer of a paid bundle, so that now instead of paying like instead of spending 30 bucks for two subscriptions, now they're spending 30 bucks for four subscriptions, and that accounts for two more paid subscriptions per user? I don't know.
So basically, a record quarter, we knew it would be, but they said the future is not so bright.
Well, yeah, and I think they will sandbag. Apple is notorious
sandbag.
For sandbagging.
They back. So they don't sandbag as much as they used to. Though
they used to.
Yes. They were told not to. Right. Like they were sandbagging, and I think it was the SEC. You can't sandbag
that
much,
dudes,
because their estimates were painfully low.
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
yeah. So they warned that there were still going to be issues from foreign exchange that are going to hit them, and that they expected to decelerate. Another great financial quarter, financial word that they like to throw out there, decelerate their growth. So that means grow, but not by as much. And we don't know what that means, but what that means is that it will be less than whatever 8% growth next quarter. Now, again, holiday quarter is traditionally Apple's biggest. And yes, that means last year's holiday quarter was the biggest Apple quarter ever by far. What is unclear is, do they think they're going to beat it? Do they think they're going to come in under it? That they didn't say. All they said, because everybody, and especially Apple, has used COVID as an excuse now where they're like, well, we live in times of uncertainty, so we're not going to give a forecast. They used to sandbag their forecast, and then they were told they needed to be more realistic with their forecast, and they got more realistic. But the moment that they could just not do a forecast, they stopped. So so all we know is they think that they will grow less than 8% next quarter, year over year, and that could be 7% or 2% or minus 10%. Who knows?
Elon has now announced it's $8 a month to keep your blue check, by the way. That just
totally worth it.
Out. And I have canceled my subscription. Yeah, it's official. He just tweeted it.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter's current lords and peasants system for who has and doesn't have a blue check mark is BS.
Oh, God.
Actually, there was a reason for it, but okay. Power to the people. The reason was Tony La Russa was so mad that he sued Twitter because there was a guy impersonating him. And Twitter's response was, well, we'll give people who really are who they say they are a blue check mark. So it wasn't about lords and peasants. And now it is about lords and peasants, by the way, because it's about people who can spend $96 a year for a blue check mark. So, Elon, it's actually the opposite what you just did. But okay.
I know this is going to be a side thing, but this is just, I keep being reminded of that scene in the comedy Bananas where the revolutionary finally like is the president and makes his first proclamations and they're all just insane. Like underwear will be changed 6 times a day. Yeah. All underwear must be worn on the outside so that we can check. Anyone who's 28 years old is now 20 years old.
Elon and also says you'll get priority in replies. I don't know what that means. Mentions and search, which is essential to defeat spam and scam. Oh, I guess maybe
you won't be downgraded because you might be spam or scam. Ability to post long video and audio, half as many ads, and paywall bypass for publishers willing to work with us, which is interesting because publishers have just mentioned, including 9to5, that they are no longer going to be paid and there will no longer be free access. So anyway, I just thought I'd update you, and I'll just let me tell you how easy it is to turn off your Twitter Blue subscription. I had the I was grandfathered in at $2.99. I just went in my Apple subscriptions. Thank you, Apple, and turned it off. back to next quarter. Are they sandbagging? No.
No, I think that they.
It's reasonable they for them to say they don't it could be great. Us.
They don't want to tell us. And I think, you know, here's what I think. Nobody knows, but my guess is they're going to be like, well, deceleration, blah, blah, blah. And then when they post a 2% gain, which means that it'll be their record quarter of all time, they'll be able to say, look, I know it's only 2%, but we told you and record, and they'll just kind of skate. That's my guess. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. One of these days, they're not going to levitate for a quarter, but I don't know. They have done it in so many successive quarters that I got to think that it's going to happen again and that they're going to post another record quarter, but maybe only by a little bit and not by a lot.
Well, of course, we'll find out in 3 months.
Yeah, check back in here, more charts.
I am very happy that the Mac does well. I understand why the iPad's, you know, just basically flatline, humming along, we should probably say, instead of flatline. That sounds like it's dead. I think Apple could change that next year. Important note, Mark Gurman and Tim Cook at the analyst call.
Yes.
Said, what did Tim say? He said, we've got all the products we're going to have.
He said, we love our retail people and we are totally set with what we're going to have in stores for the holiday season. Like, totally set.
Totally set.
And then also they said next quarter, you know, remember we had the MacBook Pro launch last year. And so it's going to be a tough compare. And the implication there is, well, we're not doing a MacBook Pro launch this year. So tough compare time. So and then Mark Gurman came out and said, yeah, it's going to be next year before we get that Mac Mini and MacBook Pro update that we thought might happen this month.
And that also may mean that they think that they're going to do okay without those products this quarter. So why not put them in the next quarter? You know, like it's, you know, that means that they're fairly confident that this is going to be a good quarter for them from, you know, from what they already have in the pipe.
Yeah. I think they also say right at the top that they don't expect supply constraints to affect their future business, that they are able to, whatever their problems were last year, they're kind of on top of them. So they removed that as an excuse for bad performance for the next quarter, probably.
The old legacy nodes, another one of those things that's a term that I didn't know before. The idea that basically there was these chip shortages all over the world with like Bluetooth chips and other stuff that was like old tech, but hard to come by. And they said, it's not a problem anymore. Now, they did say some of that stuff is more expensive than it used to be. But so it may not be clear for everybody, but it's clear like for Apple's purposes, they can get everything they want, even if they have to pay a little more for it. But that will allow them to fill all orders that come in. And that's a big step for them, because I think, you know, Tim Cook has hated that, right? You know, Tim Cook hates it when somebody says, I want to give you my money. And Apple's like, oh, we can't give you a product for 6 weeks. He wants to hand them that product right then. That's his whole thing. So they seem to be back in balance there.
And by all accounts, it looks like they're going to become more and more vertically integrated that way. I mean, they're, you know, the M1 is the beginning, but they've made mention of it before. Like, what's slowing us down is all these external chips. So they, you know, I think that they're going to continue to fuse more of those things, maybe not on the chip, but it sounds like they're going to keep on customizing those until they're the only customer for the chips that they use.
iPhone on a chip.
TSMC, you know, we talk a lot about how Apple locked in their 5 nanometer process and actually TSMC wants more for 3 nanometer. They already announced that, but those legacy nodes, some of them are 16 nanometer there, and TSMC doesn't make all of them. So a lot of this comes about by paying companies to build plants to make this, you know, accelerometer chip or whatever.
Yeah. Or Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. I mean, this is why there are lots of cars that are not available or weren't available, or other like gadgets where you're like, why is this even a thing? And the answer is there's a chip in there.
Try to get a Raspberry Pi.
Well, yeah, it tried to get a Raspberry Pi as a good example. Panic has their little Playdate game thing, which is really great, but they had to like slipstream in a different processor because the low, you know, not particularly cutting edge processor that they were using just basically went out of availability for a year. Yeah. And they're like, well, what do we do? And it's not cutting edge at all, but it's one of these legacy nodes that's being used for other stuff. So that seems to be clearing up now, which is good news for all of us who are like, I want to buy a Raspberry Pi, or like that thing that I talked about last week, some embedded system that's got a little Raspberry Pi driving it. And you, for the last year, you go on these websites, they're like, here's an incredibly cool thing you can build with a Raspberry Pi. Step one, do you already have a Raspberry Pi? Otherwise, come back in a year or two because we haven't been able to buy them.
I really enjoyed on the you probably saw this on the Twit forums at twit.community. Somebody said, what the hell was that thing Jason talked about? And then what was the thing that Alex they didn't understand. Patchouli fan says, I know I'm about the opposite of a tech nerd, but is it bad that I have no idea what Jason's pick of the week was or what it does?
Yeah, well, let me give you the elevator pitch. It's a little computer and a screen that is so low power you can run it on a battery and you can program it to show whatever you want.
Yeah. Kind of a number of us jumped in to try to explain. I don't know if Julie Ben was satisfied. And then she said, because then along came Alex's picks, which mystified me even further.
Andy, you're letting us down. Get weirder, okay?
Oh, your pick.
I don't remember what I was talking about.
Your pick was the thing that lets you see what the shot's going to look like through your iPhone.
Oh, Artemis.
Yeah. Which is useful to only somebody who's making a movie. Like a film?
Well, I feel like that's my role here, is to provide.
I am not complaining on either count. I thought it was hysterical. But that's, in fact, I celebrate it. That's right. Look at the weather. You see? It's raining. Yeah.
And mine's just a lens preview. Lens preview is all it is.
Yeah.
Lens preview for big lenses.
I never want you guys to be less than the ultimate geeks that you are.
Gotta be nerdy.
Gotta be nerdy. That's the future of this show.
I love that one of the nerdiest people I know, Andy Anatko, was not the one called out there. That is amazing. Good job, Andy.
Well,
I'm
the one y'all would like to have a Diet Dr. Pepper with. I'll sit around the old Cracker Barrel and talk about property tax, and I hope I have your support in November.
I think actually one year pick of the week was in fact Mexican Coca-Cola.
Yep. So, love it.
So there you go.
didn't result in the sponsorship, but okay.
No, we tried.
You know, it's hard to miss
100% of the shots you don't take.
It's going to be it's actually going to get harder and harder, I think, for us to make money as podcasters. This is one of the things that we talked about on the Gray Matter podcast with Michael Krasny. The future is not bright for podcasting. Now Amazon has announced. And actually, this hurts Apple, too, I think, a little bit. If you are an Amazon Prime subscriber, you will have the full music catalog of 100 million songs available to you, plus ad-free podcasts. Now, this is kind of like Apple's $5 iTunes thing, right? Because you can't say play a particular song. You're going to get shuffles and stuff. But right. I bet they know that most people, that's fine, right? I don't that often ask for...
Is it really? Is it?
Well, maybe it isn't for you. I don't know.
I thought. Yeah.
The thing is the compelling power of I want exactly what I want and I want it for free as an entitlement. Never underestimate the power of that. There are people who are saying, well, how about if we charge you less for Netflix, but you get ads? So, no, I should be able to share. Well, my class reunion should be all people who share the same Netflix passwords, those passwords. Bastards trying to, So I think that people will gravitate towards free. They might gravitate towards piracy as well. For people, and people, it's not the ease at which it is possible to find that thing that you want to find for free without DRM is the bar is becoming lower and lower and lower. And I think that a lot of these services are going to have to respond to that. But free content is becoming table stakes now. If you want people to get on board, you're going to have to give them stuff for free, and then you're kind of have to kowtow to them and give it to them in a way in which they are demanding it, because it may be right, maybe wrong, but that's the market that's out there.
So you can ask for an artist, but it'll shuffle play the artist, or an album, but it'll shuffle play it. You can't listen to the album. Artists must hate this in order. You can have a playlist you can ask for. You can have personalized playlists. It's actually pretty much everything except for I want this particular song. I think it probably depends how you're listening. But remember, if you're you're using an Amazon Echo to ask for this stuff.
Yeah. But a lot of the market has changed. Obviously people aren't buying tracks anymore. But a lot of the marketing has changed to people don't listen to necessarily to albums. They listen to playlists, and they often listen to them through smart assistants, so that they are saying, give me the flash funky 80s playlist, and the songs that are in there are going to get the play. So it's not so much here is an individual track that got a lot of attention and become the hot track of the summer. Is that these thanks to marketing, thanks to ad dollars, these tracks that they want to promote got into popular playlists that are being promoted, that are at the very, very top of the service for people who are getting this thing for free, and people who are just asking for, I don't care what you play me, just play me songs that are like this through their smart speakers.
It's another step into turning music into wallpaper. And I suspect people like you, Alex, who are more discriminating, you'll buy Apple Music and continue to pay for it.
I have Apple and Spotify. I can't imagine really spending a lot of time listening to music that I didn't choose.
I'm
sure there's people out there.
But you'll say, I want to hear play the latest Taylor Swift album, and it will play it out of order, and shuffle. So it's like you're not choosing it.
It would be like hell for me.
I thought. Yeah.
It's not only that I want to listen to the music. I want to listen to this song exactly after this song, after this song, this song. I have like 80 playlists. I used to be a music director.
But you can make a playlist. And you can say, I want to play my playlist. Look, this is basically the music catalog of Apple Music or Spotify without any fee. You're already paying the Amazon Prime fee.
I'm just not going to use it.
Doesn't appeal, does it?
Like, it doesn't mean anything to me. Amazon Prime. I take advantage of Amazon Prime every time I order something, which is almost daily. So I'm fine with what I get.
This is another big step killing RSS podcasts, the stuff we do, independent podcast networks, because they're going to offer ad-free versions from CNN, NPR, The New York Times, ESPN, and they own Wondery, so all the Wondery podcasts. And basically, those podcasts are pull off RSS, and they're ad-free. And I just, I know this is kind of inside baseball, but Jason, you do a lot of ad-supported podcasts. I feel like this is tough for us, because now they're getting us on both sides. They're making it harder for us to sell ads, because they're pulling these all in-house and they're selling the ads with lots more demographic information, lots more, tracking. Or, hey, don't have any ads at all. And it's hard to compete against. I mean, you can't listen to Twit without ads on Amazon, but maybe.
Yeah, it's tricky, too, because you're talking about, it's similar to that Elon Musk statement about we're going to give this money back to the creators. It's like, no, you're not. You're going to keep it for yourself, right? That's the question is, what's the strategy? And if it's I think the dream of everybody with these podcast things is that they eventually want to be like YouTube or TikTok, where they have a bunch of creators and the money goes to them, and then they are kind enough to give some of the money to the creators. And anybody who's worked under that regime will tell you it's not so great.
It sucks.
And that's why YouTube creators have Patreons, because the YouTube money is not good enough and it doesn't work that well. And the nice thing about podcasts up to now has been we get to have some control and can set it up and say, no, we'll take care of this. And big companies are like, no, we want to be the middleman for you. And it's like, we don't want you. We go away. We don't want you. But if that's where the listeners are, you can't tell them to go away. So we'll see how they do. I mean, people say a lot, big companies do a lot of declarations about how they're going to change podcasting, and they haven't done it yet. But Spotify is the one that's had the most, I think, success. A lot of people are listening on Spotify.
Yeah. Well, if you want to hear Rogan, you got to.
People are in that app, right? I think that there's some sort of, I don't want to say laziness, but let's say inertia, where it's like, well, you're already in Spotify,
right?
And now you want, and there's a podcast and you listen to it, and suddenly, I mean, you surely have seen it and we've seen it. The percentage of our listeners across various podcasts listing in Spotify, it's not huge for our nerdy tech podcast, but even there, it keeps going up. Yeah. Like, it keeps going up.
It works.
Yeah, this is the principle of good enough. It's like there's so little difference between streaming music services at this point. You can say that, this one has spatial audio, this one has high resolution music, but for the core feature that people want, like launch app, hear music, there's so little difference between the three that whichever one got their loyalty early enough, there is, as Jason says, the inertia. There's not enough going on in a competing service from Spotify that would make you switch from Spotify to something else. Even though I do prefer Spotify's overall interface to Apple Music and pretty much everything else. But again, a lot of it is just that it's good enough. It gives you, there's such little differentiation between them that it's hard to really get people to say, you know what, I'm ditching this. I'm going for that.
It's going to be it's an interesting world where these silos are just, it's such a strong economic driver. Look at Apple. It just, there's so much incentive for a company to do this. And that's just the way it's headed. It's a little scary. And I feel bad. Screw podcasts. Who cares? But I feel bad for musicians because I really feel like music is being turned into wallpaper for a whole generation. It's just, It doesn't matter what you're listening to. It's just music. It's in the background. It's like being in a Vegas casino. It's just a bunch of songs.
But I will say one thing. It's nice that that there are so many different ways to discover music right now. There's so many different ways for music to come to people's attention. And as soon as as soon as you hear that, wow, there is this artist named Lizzo. And some people are kind of upset because she was playing a flute. Wow, there's a hippo. And I wonder what this Lizzo person is like. And then seconds later, you can be listening to her entire catalog and suddenly become a big fan of hers. Whereas before it would have been, I don't know if I want to go to a record store. I don't know if I want to spend $10 taking a flutter on a CD. I may or may not like it. I hope it balances out in terms of bringing in new fans and new.
I'll tell you one thing. I have, of course, purchased the entire Lizzo catalog, but I bought it again so I could play it in Beat Saber. is a lot of fun in Beat Saber to play Lizzo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I look at the sheer volume or breadth of understanding my kids have of music because they don't have to buy it. So, you know, the thing is that my daughter, I mean, she can play you for hours. She can play you big band. She loves big band. Nice. So she's 13 years old.
Awesome.
But what she does is she listens to a song that she knows, and then she just lets it keep playing, and then she starts favoriting the ones that she likes.
She's got a way about her,
and she knows all of these songs that I don't know anything about. My wife and I are pretty eclectic, and when it comes to, you know, music, they just have gone everywhere, and they have, you know, these obscure 70s and 60s and, you know, 30s.
That is a big improvement.
And it's, because I can only listen to what my parents had.
I couldn't.
Your friends, you know, like, yeah. I grew up listening to what my cousins and my friends.
What was on the radio.
You know, right. Know what was on the radio. And she has this incredibly, and my son as well, but both of them have an incredibly wide range and deep range of knowledge because they didn't have to go out and buy something every single time, and because they didn't have to wait for the radio. I think there's a lot of artists that would have been more successful had we not been in such a vertical radio market. And I used to work in that market. There were tons. I have these playlists called Lost Alt, which is Lost Alternative that I have in my thing, which is bands that never made it. And I was a music director, and I saw the songs come through, you know, and they just didn't, you know, they released on the same week as Achtung Baby, or they released on the, you know, and they never made it, you know.
I think
there was no reason for that other than just luck.
I think there's a myth in the back of people's heads that, oh, the recorded music, the musicians who have labels are the best musicians. And it isn't that at all. It's whatever the record label thought they could successfully package. Air Supply, of all things. Air Supply is coming to the casino up here. I saw a big billboard say, you know, tickets on sale now for their April appearance. And I thought, Air Supply, really? And then so I said, well, let me listen to an Air Supply song. I remember these songs. And it's just completely pablum. It's terrible. So some record executive somewhere, it's not that they were, oh, they're so great, I can't wait to sign them, they're going to be huge. Some record executive somewhere packaged it. That's all.
Well, in some cases. I mean,
A&R,
when I was at Sony, A&R was a big deal. And they were pretty, basically someone took on an artist. And, you know, there were definitely people who were packaging them, but there was a lot of them.
That's why music
was
better in the 70s. It's not that way anymore. Right?
I wasn't a music director in the 70s. Oh, okay. I'm not that old. So the, I was in the 90s. But they would grab onto an artist, and then kind of championing that artist within the label of, I think this is, you know, I think, you know, I remember for me when I was there, it was like Pearl Jam. Like someone found, you know, like we're going to, then someone had to get Pearl Jam signed. you know, yeah. like from where they were.
Well, how do you explain Air Supply?
No. I think that the '70s were a weird time. I mean, it was like it was the Carpenters and the Carpenters and Air Supply. And
I feel like even today, record labels look well. What's their, you know, how good looking are they? Are they sexy? Do you think we'd get teenage girls coming out to see the concerts? Okay, now let's send them to a studio in Norway and turn that music into gold. And I feel like there's a lot of
Sweden.
Sorry,
Norway.
Nothing good ever came out of Norway. No, there's a whole. That's what. There's a whole thing. A Swedish like factory.
It all came from ABBA.
And
so they produced it, and there's this cottage industry there where they.
That's
just,
how Britney Spears happened. Britney Spears.
It's all Max Martin's fault.
Britney Spears. Somebody said, "Oh, she's young, she's sexy. Send her to Sweden," and they recorded, you know, "Hit Me, Baby, One More Time," and the rest is something.
Sure. Yeah.
And by the way, no, I love my friends in Norway, and I'm sorry I said that.
Yes, exactly.
A lot of people get found by going viral now, though. That's the other thing that happens, whether it's SoundCloud or TikTok or something like that. There are lots of artists who
made his success on TikTok, right?
And then they go into the machine.
Yeah. And then they go into the machine, yeah.
Sometimes they're already in the machine.
It's created? No, Lil Nas X wasn't. That was a $30 beat he bought. For Old Town Road, you think that was? You think they like come here, kid?
Yeah, they're so no. It's just that they use that platform a lot now. You know, like so sure.
now they know.
There's a totally. You want it to feel like it's coming up from nowhere.
Yes.
Because you know, when we were in alternative rock, there was this thing, even though there were bands coming through that like Pearl Jam, we knew that Pearl Jam was going to be big AOR. So, but as Pearl Jam came through, they had to do the stop through alternative rock, or the alternative rock folks would never listen to them again. You know, like if they went straight to AOR or pop, they'd just be ignored by this whole, you know, they had to kind of go through that process. Same thing with live and other ones like that. And so that you there was a process of getting certain kinds of guitar based bands through. In the same way now, you want people to be you want it to feel like it's coming up, like Billie Eilish or Lil Nas X or whatever, and you want it to feel that way, whether it actually is or not.
No, remember Halsey had this rebellion where she was really pissed off because the labels were pushing her to TikTok or songs because it was the best way to promote. You know what? They've lost radio. That's part of the problem. They used to have a vehicle to promote songs.
Well, this gets back into not wanting to listen to something I don't want to listen to. I mean, I never listen to radio. I mean, I was a music director for a radio station, and I haven't heard more than, you know, 10 minutes of radio in probably a decade.
I know.
You know, like it's very unusual.
Yeah.
No, I love the fact that people can kind of come from unexpected places. And there's an artist that I really like named Maggie Rogers who, you know, she had tried, she was in bands and she tried to break and it never worked. And she went to a like a master class at what, NYU, I think. And she played one of her songs for Pharrell Williams and he starts to cry during it. And that goes viral.
You're going.
And Maggie Rogers immediately has a record deal and she finally makes it. But what it took was Pharrell to hear her song and cry a little and have that go viral. And I love it because she's a great artist. And again, I think there is some argument to be made that being through the viral filter of TikTok or, you know, or any other place or SoundCloud back in the day where something can go truly go viral, I think it says something about you as an artist. It may not say that your stuff is the greatest, but it means that it had a resonance somehow. Well, and that's good. I mean, we would never have heard of Maggie Rogers had Pharrell not wept at her song Alaska. So it's pretty awesome.
And then the question is, can you maintain it? You know, like in This Week in Music, but can you maintain it? You know, like you look at Trendsetter as a good example. Trendsetter was really popular on TikTok back in the early days of TikTok. And, you know, the original song was not listenable in my opinion, but then it got remixed and it's gotten, you know, 250 million listens or something like that on YouTube. And but both the remix artist and the artist that sang it are gone. Like, you know, like they're somewhere, but they're not, you know, and you have one hit wonders all the time, but it is, it's really hard on your own to leverage that without the infrastructure of the industry. So we say that we're going to get rid of the industry, but you know, there's still there's still a lot of reasons to have some management that's helping you do it. The question is, are they helping you, or are they enabling all your bad habits so they can make more money? You know, so that's always the challenge.
Yeah. This is a perfect example of how the internet has completely flipped everything around and changed it. And everybody's trying to figure out how to survive. And Apple's decided that putting more gambling ads in the App Store is really the way to make it.
That went really bad, really fast. like it was like, wow, did that when you don't see Apple wipe out very often. But a lot of us have been, you know, like that was just a complete wipeout. And cause I watched it. I watched everyone getting really upset. I didn't see very many of them, and I was just like, but I was like, wow, people are really upset about this. And I think overall Apple should just be out of ads. Like, I know that it's a growing market for them. They should not.
Yes.
Apple I don't know why Apple changed their tune. By the way, they've now said we're going to put a pause on gambling ads. But
they should put a pause on ads.
Yeah, well, they should, but they're not. Mark Arment's tweet, I'm guessing Marco has some pull over there. Now my app's product page shows gambling ads, which I'm really not okay with. Apple shouldn't be okay with it either. The App Store has corrupted such a great company so deeply. They make so much from gambling and the manipulative in-app purchases, they don't even see the problem anymore. So here's his screenshot of being featured as the app of the day, Overcast. You might also like William Hill's sports betting, bet on football. Of course, everybody who listens to Overcast wants to bet on football and horse racing. Apple realizing this was a black mark on their escutcheon.
Yeah, but you would think that they would say... It wasn't that they had this file of 1,000 categories that they just dumped into the ad system. It's like this was a considered act, and maybe at some point someone might have thought perhaps we should make sure that people who are looking for mental health apps and apps that help you to quit addiction to gambling do not see ads for gambling apps. No, apparently not. It's rare that you, but I mean, Alex is spot on. It's rare that you see a cell phone like this from Apple, a story that begins with, in retrospect, this was an obvious mistake.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're a product company, right? They're a product company. And so the idea here is that they want people to be loyal customers. And yet these ads are not only cynical because you have to go to the App Store, there's no alternative. And they've already had, you know, they're taking money, they're extracting more money out of app developers by having them say, you know, they take their 30 or 15 in some cases percent. And then they say, but you know, if anyone wants to find your app, you got to take some of that 70 or 85% we gave you, and you got to give it back to us so that we can make your thing visible, right? Like, it's already kind of a racket, and it wouldn't be so bad if there were alternatives, but because it's exclusive, it's the only place you can go. And with app tracking transparency, a lot of other app marketing has disappeared now. And so it's really the only place you can go. So it's already kind of gross. This is just like a layer. The fact that it's so lazy, that it's not really categorized, and it's just like sell into everywhere. You're butting into some place that you're not even relevant there, but we're going to put you there anyway, just to get your nose in the door here. And there's nobody, and I admit to having strong feelings about this because I spent the last like 5 years of my old corporate job as arguing with salespeople who kept wanting to incrementally increase revenue by making the product worse. And depending on who my boss was at the time, I was sometimes the only voice in the room saying, you're going to drive away our customers and our audience. And our customers are our audience. Our customers are not our advertisers. They are our audience, and without them, we're nothing. And I wonder sometimes, looking at Apple and the App Store in the modern day, if there's anybody there with a voice who can be heard to say no to incremental revenue because it hurts the product. And this action is a sign that there isn't.
Yeah, I have always thought the worst thing about the App Store and approaching being disgusted by this is that I, as a consumer, I don't get to simply say, well, show me every text editor that you have. Well, no, we'll show you the top X of them. We'll show you ones that are being promoted. We'll show you ones that are being advertised. We don't care if you're willing to sit there and just scroll for 2 hours. it's if it's not something that Apple has in some way selected to be presented in front of you, you're just not going to find it unless you hit upon the magic keyword that will surface this thing that that you didn't know you were looking for, but you're glad that you found. You're kind of out of it. It's a terrible way to treat app developers, and it's a terrible way to treat customers.
And it's so corrosive because it gives Apple Apple doesn't have any reason to make App Store search or other App Store algorithms better, right? Because Apple could theoretically make it so good that it's like, oh, we know about you because, of course, they can track you because it's all first party and therefore it's not gross or creepy. And we know about you and we built an algorithm so we know what apps you're going to like. But if they do that, they kind of undercut their search business. So they just don't. And the search and the algorithms in the App Store aren't very good. So it's corrosive on that way. And then John Gruber made a good point on Daring Fireball this week where he pointed out how the perception among members of the public is that all of those App Store editorial stories where there's actually an editorial team at Apple who writes stories about apps that they think are cool and has nothing to do with paid placement. It's entirely editorial. I mean, it's marketing, right? Because it's the App Store and it's Apple, but it's entirely the decision of the people in App Store editorial about what they want to feature. And everybody thinks those are ads. And that is another one of these side effects. But once you open the door to content in the App Store being for pay, even when you create not for pay content, people just assume that somebody paid somebody to write this nice feature about them, even though that's not true. So there's so many knock-on effects of Apple getting into the ad business, especially in the App Store. I think they're all bad. And I think the question is it worth it? Is the extra incremental worth it? I just don't see how it is, but there's nobody to tell them no.
It's just such a small amount of revenue, and maybe they'll grow it into something. But the more it grows, the worse it will feel. You know, so the more successful they are, the more weird it's going to be. And, you know, especially when they're blocking other tracking and everything else, I completely agree that is just like it's so easy right now because they are a product company. They are not dependent on advertising for them to be above it. You know, to just say, hey, our environments are not that. Our environments don't do that. And it's a nice, clean, quiet place. When we recommend something to you, it has nothing to do with money. It has to do with this is the most likely thing that you'd like. I just feel like that's the Apple. That should be the Apple approach to this, not money grubbing,
well,
which is what it feels
the
like.
The Apple approach to it is just to keep it covert. Out of Sync says in our IRC, loot boxes are basically gambling. And that's how most apps make money, and Apple makes 30% on those loot boxes. Just more covert, right? It's not as obvious as an actual ad for a gambling app. The NFL advertises and now is shares in gambling revenue from FanDuel and DraftKings, and I think that's really tarnished their reputation. But get ready, you know, with a radio station I worked at in San Francisco just closed down. It's news talk in favor of a sports gambling format. This is the way the world is going. It's kind of the crapification of everything.
I think the reason the app developers got so mad about this is that because the App Store is their only home that they're allowed on the platform, and that means that basically, like, if you're Marco Arment, your entire Overcast business is really built around the Overcast product page.
Right.
And it's not as if Apple comes to Marco and says, hey, Marco, can we put some ads on your page and we'll cut you in for a rev share? No. Apple says we're going to just put anything we want, including stuff that you hate, on your page. And there's nothing you can do about it. And we get all the money. And you have no recourse because you're trapped in our platform and there's no alternative to the App Store. And that, it's like, again, is each one of those, is it in itself like a little micro offense? But you put it all together and it's super offensive.
Back in August, Mark Gurman said this is because Apple advertising VP Todd Terese began reporting directly to Eddie Q, and that Terese told Q, I'm going to increase our advertising revenue from $4 billion annually to billions in the double digits. I'm going to more than double it. And apparently Terese has had free reign ever since.
This was in the
Gurman newsletter that said, and it hasn't, I don't know if it's happened yet, they were going to looking at ads in the Maps app as well. Of course, Google already does that.
So who's able to say no to that guy? And right now I feel like nobody's saying no to that guy. Although this week or last week, maybe somebody realized you cannot give that guy free rein, because I hate to make a villain of any person, because I don't know what's going on the inside, but I'm just going to come out and say it. I think this guy's a villain. I think this guy has been, his job is to do things that I think are fundamentally corrosive to Apple's products. And the question is not this guy. I mean, I can say he's a villain. He's doing his job. The problem is, who's his boss? Is it Eddie Q? Who is Eddie Q okay with the junkifying of all of Apple's services? Is Tim Cook? Who is there to weigh what this guy wants to do in terms of bringing in incremental small amounts in most cases of revenue and weigh it against how much worse the product is?
Yeah, but if it gets to $10 billion a year, it's not that incremental.
It's not. Well, I mean, all right, let's see it, though. But it's incremental compared to the iPhone, right? Like, this is the
Apple doesn't need to do it, is your point.
Whether it's incremental or not,
they don't need to do it. Yeah.
But also what I find a little bit suspicious is that obviously Apple didn't talk about the ad revenue business, ad part of their business during the majority of the call. Tim was asked specifically about it during the Q&A by an analyst, and he parried the hell out of it. He said, well, privacy is a fundamental right. We're not doing anything that steps away from the blah, blah. And our specific advertising business is not large in relative to others and so forth. That's not me. That is actually not large.
We're not Facebook. We're not Google.
But we don't release the exact numbers on it, but it's clearly not large. Well, if it's a multi-billion dollar part of your business, maybe you should. And someone asks you specifically, asking, are there any metrics, any vectors you can talk about to give us a sense of how big those businesses are? Yeah, it's suspicious that he parried the hell out of that one. The only other one that he parried off, interestingly enough, were questions about Apple's labor relations. So make of that.
Also not the best record in the world.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, you know, Apple's a, look at this. I've said this for a long time. Apple's a corporation. They're not your buddies.
Of course.
Well, they're not your friends. They have a fiduciary responsibility to the stakeholders to make profit. And I think to some degree, we've really set it up in this country that there is actually a bit of discord between companies whose incentives are to make money and customers who say, well, what about us? And a lot of times what companies do to make money does not serve the customer, but I think that's not their incentive.
I think the argument is that whatever they make with the advertising, it may cost them more money in the long run. So even from a stockholder position,
I would hope they would think that, but they don't think
long-term. Some of the shininess of the platform.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
Just by having a shinier platform and a quieter platform will probably make them more than the advertising will. It's just an unforced error.
They need somebody like Jason Snell did at his magazine to step forward and say, no.
Well, that's it's so hard to turn down extra money, and I get it. And so, and especially, I will say, when you're at a tech magazine company in the 2010s, you're in way more dire financial straits than Apple is.
That's right.
But even there, it's so hard to turn down more money, right? Because the answer is, what they'll say to you is, the ad salespeople, like this guy, will say, but it's just more money. There's no downside. There's more money. And the answer is, there is no such thing as a free lunch. There is always a downside.
Yeah.
But the downside is the bigger picture. And you need someone who sees the bigger picture. And that's why, again, I can't really demonize this guy who I already called a villain, because he's doing his job. The problem is, who gave him his job? Who gave him his incentives to do his job? And who is looking at what he does and evaluating whether it makes sense for Apple's business as a whole? And I get the feeling that up to now, they basically let him do whatever he wants. And somebody needs to say, Todd, that's off limits.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody has yet.
That's leadership, where you're taking the holistic view of the company, not just this bottom line revenue. We deal with the same thing. You know, every time I've worked in radio, you take every advertiser who walks in the door. Doesn't matter how horrible they are. And when I started Twit, I said, no, look, I really would like to make sure that I would like to say no to advertisers. I want to make sure that we only have ads that I can legitimately endorse. And that's a hard, especially when companies are troubled, that's a hard line to hold.
It is brutal to be the person who says, let's not take this check that this guy is handing us.
Yeah.
But I'm that's very why fortunate. You have to be adult enough to have the big picture thing, which is like, what does this do to my business if I take this check? Does it make my product worse and my customers who are my listeners or readers or viewers or whatever, or iPhone users, less happy?
Right.
And does that have a knock-on effect that I need to worry about big picture? Because the salesperson is in their incentive is to sell because they get probably a commission, right? There's probably even a percentage attached to it. Their job is not to think. It's like they're like a shark.
Well, not only that, somebody's cracking a whip saying sell more. So
it's not their job.
They're not incentivized
to say wait.
No. And it's the job of management to say, okay, not that one. And thank God I have Lisa, who understands when, and I have approval on every advertiser. She understands, you know, sometimes we're going to say no to advertisers. Sometimes we go, there was a company about 8, 9, 10 months ago that wanted to they wanted to sell Bitcoin in your 401k. And I said, I don't think we want to do that one. Thank God. All right. I have to take a little break. We'll come back. Much more to talk about. But we do have to do an ad. And of a nice company that we like and approve and think very highly of. Actually, a company anybody who runs a shop with a lot of Apple devices will want to know about. Maybe you already know about Adigy. Adigy, A-D-D-I-G-Y, helps you do more than just manage your Apple devices. It's the only fully cloud-based, multi-tenant Apple MDM platform designed for scalability. Adigy gives you the features, the functionality, the flexibility you need to customize and manage your Apple devices how you want. You know, I think probably every shop now is to some degree an Apple shop, thanks to BYOD. But you can ensure your Apple infrastructure is optimized to best support your environment and help your team be as productive as possible every day. Adigy helps simplify Apple IT management by creating a solution that's totally flexible, totally customizable, so any IT team can use it to easily maintain and secure the Apple devices in their managed networks the way they want to. Adigy helps you ensure every Apple device, not just iPhones, iPads, Macs, every Apple device is secure, supported, ready to scale. And Adigy is different because they support some features that I know you want, like zero-touch deployment. You don't want to have to get on every system. You can get new members onboarded securely in under 5 minutes, hands-off. Secure authentication with trusted providers eliminates the security gaps. With tested, authenticated features your users can rely on, you get real-time device monitoring, automated remediation, which is fantastic. You can resolve issues automatically before they even cause downtime. Custom compliance features, more and more, this is important. You'll enjoy peace of mind knowing your Apple infrastructure is always compliant and up to date. You get self-service capabilities, which means your IT team doesn't have to handle endless reset requests with 24/7 access to resources and applications for your users. They like that too. Patch management's very important with any system. Of course, Adigy completely automates your patch management, preventing delays, fixing bugs early, minimizing downtime by rolling out new updates and patches ASAP. And as I said, it's very easy to customize. It'll scale to meet any needs. It'll adapt to any environment. It's fast, free, catered migration, an MDM tool that works as hard as you do at the speed of now. So get started today with Adigy's award-winning support. When you partner with Adigy, you get white-glove support from a team of experts who live, eat, and breathe Apple. Apple's not a second thought, not an afterthought, not a second-class citizen. It's what they care about. They care about your success as much as you do. Adigy is not a cookie-cutter MDM. They're kind of obsessed, in a good way, with helping you secure and scale your Apple environment. Sounds good? Let's get to work. Guarantee your Apple success with Adigy. Here's what you do. Go to Adigy, Adigy.com/twit. You get a fast, free, and easy 14-day trial. Being proactive doesn't have to be a pain in the asterisk. Start your trial and learn why more than 4,000 companies use Adigy to remotely track, configure, manage, and secure their Apple fleet. Try it free for 14 days. Adigy.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting MacBreak Weekly. And remember to use that address, /twit, by the way. That's how they know you saw it here. Adigy.com/twit.
some executive movement. Yeah, I don't know if it means a lot, but, you know, Apple's online store chief, Anna Mathiasen, is leaving. And their CIO, Mary Demby, is leaving. So that's three vice presidents in recent weeks. If you include Evans Hanke, who is the design officer, is also leaving the company.
I wonder how much of that movement that Apple historically gets is based on the fact that there is a definite ceiling that you are not going to breach, that either you're part of the club that is going to be, you know, one of the elite six, or you are basically going to have a really good career as a vice president of retail, and that's as far as you want to go. But if you want to run an entire company, if you want to have more responsibility than just running retail part of a large corporation, you're gonna have to go someplace else. It is a lot of people leaving in the short span of time, which isn't suspicious, but it's interesting, isn't it?
I think it also has something to do with the high stock valuation and, the many, many splits. Yeah, sure. And I think some of these people are going, hey, you know what? I'm just looking at my my portfolio here, and I don't have to work ever again. Demby has been there for three decades. She's retiring as the CIO. Yeah. Losing Evans Hanke, I think we talked about this last week. I think that's a bigger deal. She was Johnny Ive's handpicked successor in charge of industrial design. I think that's a big deal. Chief Privacy Officer Jane Horvath has also left. She took a job at a law firm, interestingly. Yeah, I don't think it doesn't mean anything. It's just, you know, it's normal transitions, but
I do think there's very little churn at Apple. I agree that once you get to a certain level, you're probably going to have to go somewhere else to go any further. No, it's a good job. Once you're there.
It's got to be a great job.
It's like wanting to be the captain of the Enterprise D. The captain is really there. His first in command is turning down transfers to captain other ships. Yeah, you're going to be on the third seat for quite a while.
The one kind of more revolving door is the retail job. There have been quite a few people running Apple's online, not retail, online store. That online store to me still feels very janky. The back end, there's something, it's not using
web objects. I don't think it's there anymore. But
no, but it feels like it. It's a, you know, well, it feels a little janky.
They did that whole thing where it was like the online equivalent of how there's no line at the Apple store in person, where they like said, no, there is no Apple store on apple.com. You just buy things wherever you are. And then a couple of years ago, they're like, we need a store. And they put the store back. I feel like they're still kind of getting over that. I think the experience on the Apple store, having bought a bunch of stuff there, it's
gotten better
online.
But occasionally, I just went there. Okay, this is what I got. So this is the page I got when I just loaded the Apple store. This is the John. I think John's 404. John Ash. Oh, there you go. Store. This is the entire page. The best way to buy the products you love. Store. Oh, wait a minute. There it is down here. But there's a whole bunch of white space there and no products.
I see stuff there. So you.
No, I know. It just didn't finish loading. But I'm telling you, that's some portion of people are going to see that. And I personally see that all the time. I guess I'm used to that. Maybe you don't see it if you're in Safari on a Mac. Maybe that's really the problem, because I'm not always, in fact, I'm rarely on. See, I just refreshed it, the same thing. Store. They say Apple Store. Show it again. Store. It just says Store. let me refresh it again. Yeah, no. So there's something wrong. That's a hard refresh. Something wrong with their web objects. I'm telling you, they need to. You know what you should do? Go to Tesla. Get 50 Tesla engineers. Those great people have written the full self-driving software. Bring them in to review the code. Have your software engineers print it out for them. And I think
great idea.
I love that. I love it.
$1 billion idea.
By the way, talk about being a crap boss. You saw the way Elon decided to add the, what was it, some feature, blue check, I guess, is to say, you have 1 week to do it, and if you don't do it, you're fired.
Yeah.
That's very apprentice. That's like, Okay. Yep. Glad I'm not working for him.
The way to get it all working great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's the way to get, you know.
Nothing like the new guy coming in to say, hey, I created a company for tunneling Teslas between two cities. That kind of genius is applicable to everything.
We went. We were staying at the Resort Worlds when we were in Las Vegas last weekend. I'm kicking myself because it was the only place. There's a boring tunnel from that hotel to the convention center. That's it. Back and forth in a Tesla. That's the tunnel. And I wish I'd gone in it. It's only $350 for a day pass. You ride all day, all you want, back and forth in the tunnel. It's only about two blocks or three blocks. It's not very far.
But it'll totally scale up. No problem. Absolutely no problem. Just that man is a genius.
Genius. Has anybody tried Freeform yet? It's the public beta's out. Have you tried it, Jason? You seem like a public beta kind of guy.
Yep. It's. I need to spend more time with it. But it's. I feel like we haven't had an app like this in a little while where maybe Clips, where Apple actually is making essentially what would be like a first. It's like a third-party app from a first-party developer where they're actually trying to say, we're going to build something using our technology and have it be like using all our latest stuff and be something you can use. I like the idea. It's almost like an iWork app that is like, you know, remember iWork, but, you know, Numbers and Keynote and Pages. And Freeform is trying to kind of be one of those where it's collaborative if you want it to be, and you can like drop things in and sketch stuff out. And I love that they're trying it. I don't know what I think of it based on the first beta, whether it's something that appeals to me or not, but I really like that they're giving it a shot. And it does show off some of their technologies too. Apple used to be a company where all of the Apple apps were like the models that all the third party app developers would look to and say, this is what I want to be like. I want to be like these Apple apps. And that Apple kind of has lost their way on that front. So this feels an app from an earlier era in that regard.
It's going to be part of iOS 16.2, which will be out next month, apparently. But you can get it now if you're doing the public beta of iOS or iPad OS. So it looks like a whiteboard, but can you embed stuff from other works apps and stuff like that, or iWork apps?
You drag stuff in and it uses sort of like the natural drag and drop stuff. So if you drag in a web page, it'll give you like a web page preview, and it is a hyperlink, but it's also got the big web page preview.
Can we put video in there that plays or no?
I don't know if I've tried that one. The one that I thought was very cool is it actually gives you a reason to use that feature where you can lift a subject out of a photo.
Love that.
It's actually a good use of that
because
you can lift a subject out of a photo and drop it on the pasteboard there on the canvas, and then you've got it cut out, and then you can draw a mustache on them or whatever you want to do. And I don't know. One of the challenges is it is literally a freeform tool, right? It is what you want to do with it. But I think that's the idea, is a shared whiteboard that can be an accompaniment to using, you know, FaceTime or using other iWork apps. I think that's what they're going for there.
Yeah, it is a little bit weird though to me that does this merit inclusion into the main release of iOS? Does this merit something that is part of a feature set of every single iPad that Apple ships? And
well, you how get pages useful and numbers and
yeah, but those things are. No, is Freeform something you have to download from the App Store? Is it
unclear, right? It's in the OS and the betas, but it might be an App Store download in the long run. I don't know that.
Because I know that there's a Freeform switch in iCloud settings and in regular system settings. So I would think it would be, if as part of iWorks, it would make sense. It would be, I don't know. It really guarantees that, okay, we are definitely an all Apple shop now, because if we are doing all of our project, so much of our brainstorming and project management on an app that it does not exist on any other platform, whereas every other platform that has whiteboard and brainstorming software makes sure that it's available everywhere, including the web. That's quite a big ask, but it's a great show off for Apple Technologies. I just wonder why Apple is not happy. It wouldn't be happier. I wonder why they wouldn't just simply say, we're going to make sure that we feel as though collaborative whiteboard software is a really, really important sector for all of our products. We are going to be extra, extra, extra indulgent to developers of those apps and extra hands on and giving them access to stuff that other people don't have access to make sure that they can make the most beautiful and competitive apps of this kind. I don't know why, if they decide to make it as part of the actual operating system, I don't know why they would do that. I'm not questioning it. I'm saying that it doesn't make instinctive sense to me.
My question is it clips, as you said, Jason, where it's just
right.
Some guy wrote it and hey, throw that in. Or yeah. Is there something deeper there? Like, is it going to be an augmented reality thing? Is it some sort of...
I think it's more strategic, and I think it spins out of these collaboration features that they added. Although, to Andy's point, I feel like there is a group, it's like a consensual hallucination within Apple, which is, let's pretend, and it is true to a certain extent, but like let's pretend that there are work groups out there in education and in the regular working world that only use Apple devices. And they use Apple's apps to collaborate, and they use our new, because they added these new collaboration features that basically, they're very clever. What they're using is they're like using iCloud and messages, and they're tying documents together and letting you share them, and you can collaborate in a document and comment on it in messages and all that. So there's this premise that's like, they're using only our tools, and like, oh, those people who we've created, theoretically, need a whiteboard, so let's make a whiteboard for them. I think that's going on, and I think also the reason that it's tied to the operating system release is probably in part that they're tying it to those collaboration features, and that's probably where messages, it came from. Is we want to create a way, a shared some space between messages and pages or numbers or whatever that is, and there is an API for third-party apps. Like, we want to create a whiteboard space, and we don't want to build it inside of messages. So we're going to create a whiteboard space that's tied to those messages features, and I suspect that's why we ended up with this.
Yeah. That was a big takeaway from WWDC, where they introduced Freeform, that it occurred to me that Apple wants to sort of leverage messages into something not like Slack, but maybe more like a Slack, like central meeting place for people who are working together and people who are in a certain group, so that conversations will start in messages and then branch out into a free form and then branch out into actual like video chats and then document sharing all through links that are being mentioned and then actioned upon within messages. So as an extension of this, basically we want messages to be sort of the central hub of a lot of our collaboration features. It makes sense to extend out that hub more with an app like this, but again, I'm not going to really understand it until I see them demonstrate the real thing and see how it actually deploys.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. You know, I'm not a huge fan of collaboration, but I'm kind of a loner. I don't really understand collaboration.
There you go.
Yeah. So I'm not the guy.
There's a lot of places where it makes sense when you're sitting there and you want to talk about something. You want to, you know, share those ideas.
Yeah.
You know, we're in planning sessions a lot.
I never want to do that. Yeah.
Sometimes I'm doing that for hours with folks.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, yeah, and you're remote. Everybody's remote.
Yeah,
I went. When I did that Krasny show, I said, "Where's Shannon, the producer?" You said, "Oh, she's in Florida." It's like, you can't really tell. You can't tell with what you do. Everybody's it's weird.
Well, and I've been doing that for 20 years, and so you get used to it, and it's just a matter of figuring out what those tools are.
I think it's really is the future. So maybe that's what Apple's saying is, well, we know you're going to need a collaborative whiteboard, so let's make it. Mm-hmm. I want to see something more like Google Wave or OpenDoc, where it has components. Microsoft's doing something like that called Loop. That's similar.
It has a handful of components. Then it has so many components, and then they close it.
Everybody who used Wave thought, this is incredible.
But the problem with Google is that they'd always start really simple. Like someone go, okay, we're going to start simple, and we're just going to do an MVP, and it's going to come out the door. And then they just put the kitchen sink in. And then everyone's overwhelmed, and then they're like, oh, this doesn't work, and then they just quit. That seems to be the
And poor evolution. Gina Trapani wrote a whole book about it.
Yes.
It's kind of sad.
Good to RIP Hangouts, which officially died today, I think.
Today's the last day for Hangouts. Yep.
Wow.
Another
the only cool
Google
thing in
product.
The only cool thing in G Plus.
Yes,
so it was the only thing. Incredible. When G Plus opened up, I remember going, "Oh, this is such a fresh air. There's nothing, you know. It's clean, and you just have conversations." And then I really liked the idea of circles where you could have kind of intentional communities.
Yeah.
And there was all that, and then they just went, and then we'll add all the stuff that Facebook has that we don't have. And
they screwed that up, didn't they?
Yeah. I was like, okay, whatever. But you know, Hangouts was cool.
But I bet they wonder though. Gee, now that Twitter is self-immolating, I wonder if it. Let's bring Google Plus back.
Mm-hmm. I think someone probably wished they hadn't.
I think they burned the code.
Yeah. That was the only way to get the smell out, though. So they had to.
You may have seen stories about Disney World in Shanghai closing suddenly because of COVID this weekend. And people were inside still, and they couldn't get out.
Whoa.
You had to be tested to get out, and you had to test negative. I don't know where. Maybe they had somewhere to put some cots out on the... I don't know.
You can't leave. It's a small run until you're clear.
apparently, same thing's happening at Foxconn. So, in fact, there's some thought that it might affect iPhone production. iPhone workers have reportedly been walking out in significant numbers. This is from 9 to 5 Mac after an outbreak of COVID-19 at their biggest plant in Zhengzhou. So Foxconn's offering big bonuses, which is probably like $150, but whatever. I think
it's $200.
$200, that's a lot of money.
20% of their monthly income, I think.
Yeah, to stick around. $200, 1,500 yuan. For anybody who works all their shifts from October 26th through November 11th. So it's like double pay for that, you know, that two-week period or something. That's good. Time and a half.
Yeah, also
good,
burnout.
Good union good job. Heavens. Yeah. Apple has pulled Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West. There was a Kanye West Essentials playlist. The music is there. The discography's there. But the playlist, which was the Essentials from his career, for some reason is gone.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to delete.
Well, they were also one of the first music catalogs to just say, yeah, we're not going to promote it. We're going to have it if you want it, but we're not going to promote it.
Yeah. Yeah. Deleting his music seems like that would be
That would extreme. Be excessive. But
if
like,
you start
but like
doing
I said,
that, you would only have half the catalog by the time you got through R. Kelly and Michael Jackson. Pretty soon you've got nobody. There's nobody left.
Again, Eric Clapton said, "What?
Yeah, I know.
In the 70s,
I know. Holy we have to give these guys, you know, the music speaks for itself.
Yes,
as long as he doesn't speak for himself." Daniel Ek decided at Spotify not to take the music out. He says the music doesn't violate our policy.
Right.
Maybe his label will take action, but we're not going to. As reprehensible as the things he's saying are,
I think that's correct because it is as you say. There, especially as you talk about people like Ye who are saying such terrible things in modern times. Well, again, go back to 1900. Go to what did Wagner think about certain people?
Oh God, yes,
and so congratulations. One third of all the opera titles are gone, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So
And as long as the ideology doesn't creep into the music, which it may, who knows? And then at that point, you have to make some decisions as well. Is there anything else? Apple patented, I don't know why, patented the glowing apple on that they no longer have. They haven't had since 2015 on the back of the MacBook. So maybe they're bringing it back. Or maybe they just realized they hadn't patented it and they should better do that quick.
Yeah. I don't know what I think about that. I miss it because I thought it was a really cool. It was a really cool little flourish. But on the other hand, I guess I just wanted to. I guess I just want the lid of my MacBook to be more interesting than there's on the lid of my gray MacBook. There's a slightly darker gray Apple logo on it. Although I appreciate the argument that, hey, if you want it to be flashy, put stickers on it or put a shell on it. The thing is, people who don't want to be glowing have a glowing Apple logo at around a conference table, they don't have the option of not having that. But at least with the MacBook Airs, I think that one of the great opportunities for the Air, particularly in an era in which it's hard to tell the difference between an Air and a MacBook Pro these days, to basically make that the lint filter of all the fun in the Mac line. Give us the crazy colors. Give us not only a glowing Apple logo, but give us a system extension so that we can actually change the color of it.
That would be cool. That's a little too gamey. You'd only have a choice of six colors.
No, it's restraint. On Windows gaming system, they have RGB. Give us R or G or B. Just one choice. That's fine.
I do love that idea. The idea of, like, what if we brought it back and we made it more customizable or modern or cool in some way? Like, wouldn't that be great? Because, you know, if there's anything that they've killed that was fun, it was really cool. Liked that, and yeah. They're like, I know, like, there were reasons why, and it was almost accidental, right? That was like, well, if we make a cut out there, then it glows. But then it was really good, and it was good branding, and it really, really made you know that you had an Apple laptop, and other people around you to know. And for whatever reason, some killjoy in manufacturing was like, oh, no, let's not do that. And you know, now they've got their little polished Apple logo there, and it's fine, but I would love for the glowing logo to come back.
So I bought I couldn't resist. I bought the Midnight Blue M2 MacBook Air, knowing that it was fingerprint city, but I just put a clear case. It's ugly. It's
beautiful.
But
city
I put a clear case on it. So it's like the museum quality Midnight Blue. And then, you know, whenever I put a case on an Apple or any laptop, I'm really tempted to put stickers. So it'll probably end up having a bunch of stickers obscuring the Midnight Blue. But I have to say, and I'm glad I bought that. Remember, I was agonizing, like, what am I going to do when a new MacBooks come out? Well, they ain't going to come out. When will they come out, do you think? March?
Gurman says March. I think it could be earlier than that, but sometime in the first 3 months of next year, yeah.
Not June. We don't have to wait till WWDC.
I don't think so. No.
And why are they waiting?
Nobody knows, right? Like, I mean, there's speculation that they just don't need to do it, that it complicates the channel. My feeling is that it's the M2 chip, right? Because this is going to be a new level of M2 chip and getting a little more time to get that right and to get their supply chain.
So it's going to be a better M2 chip than... So because the M1 came out, they did MacBook Air, they did Mac Mini, they did the MacBook Pro 13-inch. Pause. And then how long? 6 months later? Not much longer. They put it out in the spring, and then in the fall... they put out the improved M1 MacBook Pro 14 and 16.
It was in the fall that they did the M1.
Oh, then they did the spring for the Mac.
It was in the spring for the Pro and the Mac. So that's the idea, is like you're taking that next step with that new level.
Do they want to do that every spring then? So maybe they prematurely released the M2 MacBook Air?
I don't think so. I think that they're off. I think they're off sync a little bit.
Yeah.
And that they're just, this is the next chip generation for that. And maybe they didn't have enough of them, or, you know, or honestly, I think Apple could look at its product line and say, you know, we're good. Let's not push this right now. Right. And nobody is going to kill us. I mean, I've heard from people who are like, I've been waiting for that new MacBook Pro. Yeah. Don't make me buy the old one.
Yeah.
But I think as a whole, as a gestalt, Apple could be like, you know, they're not going to kill us if we move from November to February.
Are you disappointed, Alex, because you wanted the M2 Mac Mini, right?
I do. Yeah. I think this gets back into that managing expectations. If they think they're going to hit a 1% or 2% growth, you know, for... the quarter, they may not want to goose it with anything else and give themselves a little bit more time to work on it, make sure they have a little bit more, you know, in the pipeline. It doesn't seem like there's any rush on their end. I definitely really want to buy more Mac Minis. And so I really want the M2 to come out. So I'm not investing in M1s, but the M1s are still a pretty good deal.
Yeah. I'm disappointed too, but you know what? If it does, I'm in a position where I don't have to own one in November. And if it means that waiting till March gives me one that has about 4 or 5 months of extra sophistication, or it got held up so that, I'm essentially getting the one that I would have cursed myself for not being able to buy in June because, oh my God, they just added a simple upgrade that made it so much better. Okay. I got to be okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess having a couple extra months might justify me buying it when it comes out.
Exactly.
Well, this M2 is old now. I have to say, at least when it comes to running Common Lisp, and I know this is important to you all. The M2,
bang jot dot forever, man.
That the M2 is about 20 to 30% faster. I mean, I reran benchmarks on all my software, and it is actually faster.
How does it do on COBOL?
I haven't tried the COBOL Fortran benchmarks yet, but I did do the Racket Scheme, and it's also about 20% faster. So I'm thinking that there's a these are not multi-threaded. I think it's not. It's single-threaded. So I don't. Just letting you know.
My pick of the week are the replacement key caps too, so you can get APL keyboards on an any standard ANSI layout.
Well, I figure if my Common Lisp is running faster, then my ELISP based Emacs is probably also faster. And
I was forced to learn so many terrible languages in computer science. It was like APL.
That is a pain.
I think they were just very, very. We just want to make sure you're serious about wanting to get this degree in computer science. Yeah. If you make it through this first year and you learn Snowball, okay, you are malleable enough that you will sit patiently while we teach you about anything.
I have a firm rule: I am not going to learn a new language that requires a new keyboard. That's just not going to happen. All right, let's take a little break. When we come back, if you would prepare, gentlemen, your picks of the week. Our show today brought to you by CashFly. I mean, literally brought to you by, when you go to the website, when you download our podcasts, when you subscribe in iTunes or Google, in every case, you're getting it directly from a server near you via CashFly. It's our content delivery network, and it's the best. Actually, I was just talking to Alex, and he says, I'm kind of interested in this new WebSocket Live video workflow CashFly is offering, the ultra low latency video streaming. Are you using WebRTC right now, Alex? Is that what you're?
Well, we stream in a lot of different ways. So we're using HLS, but definitely not sub 1 second. So we're using a variety of versions of HLS, WebRTC.
So you're interested in
still RTMP,
this is.
But I'm really, really interested in it.
Yeah, sub 1 second latency. Holy cow. That's just kind of mind boggling. And of course, because they have total global reach, your content is closer to your users and can be almost infinitely scaled. CashFly's ultra low latency video streaming via 50 plus locations around the globe really makes a big difference. And they can ingest multiple streams in real time. And I mean, there's all sorts of, it's worth checking this out. It's really worth checking this out. You might also be interested in something we've been using for some time, kind of unofficially. Now it's official. CashFly's storage optimization system. We store the video and audio that you're going to download on CashFly servers, which increases our cache hit ratio to 100%. And reduces our bandwidth moving stuff from an origin server over to CashFly. Reduces your S3 bills, reduces your bandwidth, increases your cache hit ratio. Check out CashFly's storage optimization system. If like me, you want them to do the hard lifting, the heavy lifting, you might want to look at CashFly's elite managed packages, fully managed CDN solutions, and man, do you get white glove service, total VIP treatment, 24/7 support, response times in less than an hour. So to recap, what do you get with CashFly? Ultra low latency video streaming that can deliver video with sub 1 second latency to more than a million concurrent users, lightning fast gaming that delivers downloads faster, zero lag, glitches or outages. That if you got a website, you will love the mobile content optimization that offers automatic and simple image optimization, so your site loads faster on any device. And because they have a multiple CDNs for redundancy and failover, they're balancing your traffic across multiple providers. You're getting the shortest routes, and you're getting amazing uptime. 30% faster than other major CDNs, a 98% cache hit ratio, and 100% availability in the past 12 months. 100%. 100%. CashFly is 10 times faster than traditional methods on 6 continents. They saved our bacon when we started Twit. Let them save yours. Especially with that 24/7, 365 priority support. They're always there when you need them. Learn more. CashFly.com.
Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com. Thank you, Cashfly, for making everything we do possible. Alex, why don't we start with you and your pick of the week this week?
So my pick of the week is a app called Moises. I believe that that's how you say it, and Moises. Moises.ai, and this is more art of, and what it does is you have to buy the track, but you take a video track, or not a video track, an audio track, you upload it, and it sends you back stems of your song. So if you take, like, let's see, I mean, it is...
What's a stem for the non-musicians?
Here, well, I'll just play you something here. You can hear this?
Yeah, that's a song.
You can hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So you hear him, he's about to start singing. Okay, now I might want to hear just the voice.
What? It can unmix the music?
Yeah. And this is just from the raw song. And then if I want to bring the drums up, that's just him with the drums.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
There's the bass.
This guy's a long way from taking the arm of the turntable and reversing the polarity.
Well, and then if I want to take the voice out to sing with it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, or the reason I got it was because my daughter plays the bass. And so I wanted to get her something that.
Without a bass.
Yeah.
She could play in the band.
Yeah. So she can she can either listen to the bass and play along with it, or immediately reverse that and take the bass out and then play along with the song. And so for learning how to do it, it's not perfect, and it's not something that, you know, you're going to steal anybody's music or anything else. Cause you can't take it from one of the services. I just buy the songs off of iTunes.
Okay.
You have to buy it off of iTunes, or you could theoretically use, you know, Downy, pull it down, rip off the thing, put it in there. So you could, you know, there's, it's not like it's checking on you or something, but you have to put up an actual video audio file. And what I've been doing is just throwing it up into my files, my iCloud files, and then it just sees the folder.
Oh, this is so cool. And now it's free to download.
Free for four tracks, up to four tracks. Okay. So you get the voice,
get the idea,
the drums, the bass.
Oh, four tracks for unlimited songs.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So you get those four. If you want to separate out the guitar, you got to pay, like, I don't know, $4 a month or something like that to separate the guitar out, or strings out, or piano out. So if you want a little bit more detail out there, you have to pay a little bit more. But in general, the free version for many people are going to give them what they want.
Well, for many of us, it's just removing the vocals, right?
So yeah, exactly.
Sing along.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the old polarity trick, except way better.
Way
faster. Yeah. You know, and you can just download it. You know, and then, of course, you can remix it, too. So you can kind of push some stuff back. So you can still, like, if you want to sing with it, but you know, you want to still hear some of it, so you can keep track of what's going on, or what, or you might want to listen to the voice just a little bit and have everything up there. All of those things are available to it. It's just a cool little app. You know, like, I was just, I did a search for it because I was trying to figure out how to separate something out, and downloaded a couple of them. And this one was the coolest one that I
separate vocals and instruments from any song. AI chord detection, AI generated metronome, click track, pitch changer.
It's really designed remix for artists to learn how to play with a song. Like, this is, I mean, that's what this is about. It's not, you know, it's really designed and has the tools that are there so that if you wanted to learn how to play a song with the song, you'd have the tools
that
you need
great
to do that.
I wish really more cool songs, they would release the, you call them stems,
we're
not tracks.
Talking about that. Yeah, I'm talking to a band that, you know, from the 90s. We're talking about the idea of recording something, like re-recording songs, but releasing them, you know, the new records as
individual
as
tracks.
Stems, or really, as what I want to do is release them as Logic files.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so that you can, but the idea for us is to be able to, you know, we'll of course, you know, stream us.
What a great way to practice being a producer, practice mixing, to use them in sampling, to use it for your music.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they don't do
well,
it.
Well, again, it's some artists are very tightly to it, and other artists who are still sometimes touring and so on and so forth, but, you know, it's not their, you know, the core.
I bet Air Supply could do this safely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think that it's a great way to learn. It's a great way to have people reimagine your music. You know, again, some of the stuff in the past when people put out those samples, I always look back on, a band called The Shaman that put out Progen. And Progen was basically all the tracks for the song called Move Any Mountain. And all of us that were doing raves at the time, you know, we just sampled all of those into our Emu Emacs. And that was just part of what we did. You know, like it was just like, and then you played that song because it had all those things that we could, you know, precursor. There's another app called Serato Pro that does this for DJs. So that separation, it'll separate all of those things out automatically inside the app so that you can do all those remix while you're in a show, and you can remix songs together. There's a bunch of examples of people doing it. So this idea of pulling stems is not new.
It's interesting, though, that AI has really supercharged it all of a sudden.
Yeah, this is the timely aspect. Is just a few days ago, they came out with a remix version of Revolver by the Beatles,
which was pulled off of a four-track. Yeah.
And it is amazing because the stereo version back then was an afterthought, and it was kind of a novelty, and it's a new stereo mix. But the way it worked is because this was not a multi-track recording. It was a four-track recording. And so... Yeah. They used the AI tools that Peter Jackson's team built to isolate all the voices and get back. They used those same tools to isolate all the tracks from the four track in Revolver. And then they were able to reproduce the album where they put the bass, because it used to be like all the instruments were on the left and the vocals were on the right. And they got to move so the bass is on the left in Taxman, but the guitar is on the right and the drums are in the center. And because they didn't have all of those instruments on their own tracks, they couldn't do it without probably among the best AI software to do this around that they built for Get Back. It's a game changer, and it's going to change the remixing of all sorts of old music, right? Because we've gotten to the point where it was good enough. I mean, I don't want to say it this way, but like it was good enough for the Beatles, essentially, that a classic album that everybody's going to know if you've screwed it up. And the software is now good enough that it sounds perfect.
Well, it's funny because I didn't know this, and I was listening to Tomorrow Never Knows, and they have a variety of versions without the vocals. But I thought I kept hearing like, something like crossfade from a headphone or something? And now I understand. Of course, it was a little bit leaked through because they might have 30 tracks in these things, but they mix them down because they don't have. They have to mix them down.
Right.
So the best separation you get is four tracks, even though they had many, many, many more tracks. So that's really interesting. I'm going to listen to that with new ears now.
And I think that Apple is doing a lot of spatializing of songs. So there's songs that are remixed from the tracks, you know, especially in the modern tracks. The last 20 years, people have the tracks, or a lot of them have the tracks. You know? So those are getting remixed. And there, I mean, you talk to people in L.A. and New York, and there's just all these houses have lit up to try to take advantage of Apple spatializing stuff, you know, and everyone wants to be part of that, that kind of wave. And so everything's getting remixed right now. And, but I think that what Apple's also doing is using a lot of, you know, whatever they're using there, they're spatializing the tunes. So they're not just stereo. When you listen to Apple Music, it gets confusing about whether this was mixed for Atmos or whether Apple spatialized it, you know, and they're not calling it Atmos when they do that, but it does feel like they've taken the instruments and moved them around, and they're doing that by reprocessing. They're not talking a lot about how they're doing that, but they are reprocessing huge amounts of the library.
You can spatialize on AirPods, you can spatialize stereo, and that's exactly what they're doing, is a processing of the stereo image to try and create a wider image. It's wild stuff, but this is, you know, so we used to think that the bounced track was the atom of music, and if you didn't have it, if it was just bounced into like five things mixed together, that was, it could never be separated, and it's not true anymore. Yeah.
Isn't that,
and especially if they stay together, like you can do a lot of things about moving them around as long as you don't change the time, because that's the tricky part of spatialization is that's exactly what we do, is our this one ear, you know, gets the audio just slightly at a different time than the other ear. And as a result, that's how we figure out where it is, where something is. It's not based on loudness. It's based on timing.
Right.
And so they have to retime things in micro, you know, things to move things around in space for us.
This is a big category. So we were talking about Moises, Moises.ai. But the chat room's come up with a bunch of other tools.
Yeah, there's lots of them.
Like Neural Mix Pro, which is available in the Mac App Store.
There's an open source product called Deezer Splitter. works with Deezer. So there's a lot of these, but Moises, I'm going to have to try. This looks really cool. The Musicians app, iPad and iPhone. Very interesting. Andy, pick of the week.
Mine is something I actually hinted at last week. It is the Panic Playdate.
I'm so jelly. So, oh.
Yeah, I pre-ordered it like last year in July when on the day the pre-orders first went up, and it took until like last month for it to actually ship. I was in group number 3, and I really like it. It's if you haven't, you might have heard of it. If you haven't, tiny little game.
Oh, it's handheld cute. Console.
It is, again, it is very, very cute. It's fun to watch, like, conventional game reviewers review it and say, oh, it's stupid. It is, has a black and white display. It's not even black backlit. And, like, and it has, oh, it has a crank, and maybe that's going to be just, like, a gimmick. And that would be very, very smart things to say for a lot of different systems. But this was, like, the people at Panic were there. They were not trying to create something that would compete with Nintendo or anything else you'd seen. They really wanted to create something that was as unique as this. And it's not often that I will pre-order on hardware, on a company that's never shipped hardware before. But I've loved their software and also their Mac software and their games so much that I knew that they would do something really, really interesting with this. And also I like the idea behind it. It's also my idea of gaming. I really don't want a Nintendo Switch. I don't want this handheld that gives me $60 games that will spend me weeks and weeks and weeks to get through. I kind of want something that's trivially small that will be in my pocket that will give me diversion on little pocket games. And one of the things I liked about it was that, of course, the big question is, oh, it's a brand new game platform, but where are you going to get the games from? Well, they said that you buy this and you will get it. Basically, there will be a season, like a TV season of games that will automatically be sent to the device to every week. And as you can see, it's a new week. And maybe you can see on the startup screen, it says, hey, there are new games available. So if I just if I wake her up and then just tap a button, see, there's a little gift box. And I tap on that. And anyway, and so basically the two new games this week will just simply download to my device.
Cute. And they're wrapped.
And they're wrapped. You don't know. Yeah. And it has Wi-Fi, has Bluetooth. It's not a backlit screen, but it's a super, super, super high contrast, high definition, black and white screen. So yeah, it won't work in the dark, but so long as there is some source of light in the room, I find that that's good. The games themselves, most of them have been very, very interesting and quirky. They're not designed to be part of a monologue joke the next day because on late night TV because they're so popular. They're designed to give you amusement for hours or days, and they have been very, very unique in how well they work. The only complaint that I will make about it is that I dearly, dearly wish that as part of the developer docs, that their developer docs are available on the Playdate site. I wish they said, please, please, please make your opening screens have documentation and explain how your game works. Because the only times that I've had now 6 games, the only times I've had bad times with them is where there is just, they just drop you in. They are not going to tell you what the mechanic is. It's not the sort of game where part of the fun is figuring out what the mechanic is. It's where it knows what the rules are. It's not going to tell you what the rules are. And then it's going to humiliate you for making mistakes because you don't know what the rules are. And so if at the very least, I wish that the developers of these games, which, oh, by the way, here is, go to our website and we will explain, here's how you score points. Here's what we're expecting you to do with this game. That's the only negative experience I've had with it. But as I had hoped and as I'd expected, it attracted a lot of very interesting and creative people to create games for this. You can also create your own games for it, either through developing and sideloading your own games with a development kit that they provide, or there's a simple like game creator that you can create through the web. So you can create your own games. There's already about 200, I think, third-party games have been released for this that you can either buy through a game store or download for free and sideload. And apparently there's going to be a second season of games coming. I don't know if that's going to cost me any money or not. But As I said, I bought this as it's not super cheap. It's $179, but I figured that for at a price per game of having an interesting piece of hardware and something that would get me sort of like something fun to play with when I'm waiting for a train or a bus, and another cute little adorable gadget to have, for me that was a good price. If you're looking for to spend $200 on interesting quirky gaming, and you don't instinctively love this idea, there are other options out there. Evercade costs like $150, and it's like a kind of like a Nintendo Switch that uses cartridges that are based on truly like 1980s, 1990s vintage games, whether Commodore 64 or arcade. So that's not going to be for you. But if you really are the sort of person, wow, that really looks very, very interesting, and I'm looking for something that's kind of different and unique, then I think you might be very, very happy with this. You're going to have to wait for it, because they are to their credit, Panic is under-promising and over-delivering. They are being very, very upfront about the fact that we are making these in like 10 units of 10,000 at a time. When we believe we will be able to start shipping things, and I'll be darned, as soon as they said, they predicted when they would be start shipping wave three, my wave hardware, and that's exactly when they started ship. And they actually delivered more games with a subscription than they actually promised. So sit tight. It's going to take you a few months to get it, but it's a good fun.
You have one. Jason has one. I'd ask you guys, you get tired of it after a while? You think it's the kind of thing you play with for a little bit and then it ends up in a drawer, or no?
I would say no, but then again, I've only had mine for like 3 weeks. I think that what it comes to, ask me again after I've had all 24 games and it's about a month later. These aren't games that are designed to give you side quests and downloadable extra content. That's Nintendo Switch stuff. This is the sort of stuff where either it's a big variety. Either it's a very simple sort of like mobile style arcade game where you're going to have a lot of fun with it with a few days, then you'll feel as though you've done whatever you can with it. Two little adventure games that might take you like a week or two to get to the very, very end of it. But I do think there are the sort of games you'll play for about a week, maybe 2 weeks, and then you're done with it and you put it away. But they're usually more games coming, and if that's why I did the financials on this based on if I were buying games for my phone at a rate of like $3 to $4 each, would I buy these like 24 25 games? Actually a little bit more expensive than that, but that's on that basis, and also because of Panic's reputation for doing really cool things, I decided to go in on it.
How about you, Jason? Where's your play date?
Yeah, so I got it in the first wave, so I've had it for a while. I think 24 games, there are just games in there I have not even begun to scratch the surface. I'm not playing it as much as I used to, but I think that a lot of it is the fact that screen, I love that screen, and I know why they made it the way they did, but the fact that it isn't backlit means you have to be in a context where you've got the play date, right, got time to play a game, and are in a well-lit location. And I don't find myself in that situation as much as I'd like. So when I do, there are some games that are very replayable on there. There's a sort of Asteroids-esque game that I absolutely love. There is a pattern matching game that is brilliant. I think what you end up after you get your 24 games is you'll find like there are five that you're obsessed with.
That's good.
There are five that five or 10 that are okay, and five and 10 that didn't click for you. But in the end, like, I think it's supremely playable. Plus there are a bunch of third party games now. I just think the it's not a fatal flaw, but the biggest flaw about it is that because they went with a non-backlit screen, there are lots of contexts where I would play more games, and literally it's not bright enough.
Like under the covers at night.
Well, even like in a room that you wouldn't say is poorly lit unless you were trying to read a book.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing where you're like, wait a second, I got to turn on a light and I got to shine it at the right angle.
Right.
So that, and a book you can kind of angle and just hold the book with, but this is a little gaming device. So you have to angle it and hold on to it and play the game. And it's just a little awkward. I hope they do another play date in the future with a screen that is that does light up at some point, because it would make it a lot more portable that way.
Yeah. On the plus side, that makes the battery last a lot longer. I agree.
What's the battery life on it?
14 days standby.
Oh, wow.
8 hours active.
Oh,
I find that the way I play it, it lasts about a week for me. Because again, these are not, it's not like Red Dead Redemption where it's like, I'm going to be in story mode for 4 hours. That was another advantage to me for it, that I don't like devices where I have to remember to keep charging it. I want it to be able to be, I can pick it up and take it and use it, whenever I want to. The same reason why I like having my Walkman digital music player, it's not a complicated one. It's a very simple one, but the battery lasts like 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. And for that, it does what it was meant to do. It is a device that will only play games for me. I pick it up for exactly that purpose, and it gets to that purpose when I pick it up. Also, I should say, very, very well made too. If you think about,
that's from Teenage Engineering. Those guys are incredible.
And they know that like a game crank is probably going to like get a lot of abuse. Right. Is very, very solid metal. There's some games where you really have to like crank it very, very fast, and I'm no longer afraid of breaking the thing off. So when it arrives, you will feel as though, okay, I get why this costs $179 and it's not like a $49 thing at Bed Bath and Beyond.
Yeah. No, Panic, which is a great software company, outsourced the hardware to a company that really knows hardware. So,
yeah. Teenage Engineering.
Yeah. Jason Snell, pick of the week.
I've got an indie Mac app for you. It is called RetroBatch. It's from Flying Meat Software. Gus Muller over there, maker of Acorn, the excellent image editor.
I love Flying Meat.
RetroBatch is a $30. There's a $50 pro version. It's a $30 app, and basically it's automation workflow for images. Oh. So if you're somebody who has to process lots of images, you can build fairly complicated. I'm actually...
it's a nodal editor.
Yeah, so for my book about photos that I'm writing for the Take Control, they actually have a workflow for this that, like, it's got like a bunch of rules, and then depending on the image, it drops a drop shadow and it changes the margins, and then it writes the images out, and you can have very sophisticated workflows that you build, and you can set up droplets, so you drag an image in and it processes it and takes it to its destination. It's one of those things that, again, it's niche-y. You got to be somebody who is batch processing images, but if you work on the web, if you work in software development, or writing books, whatever it is, I find myself pulling out RetroBatch. You know, it's only a handful of times a year, but what ends up happening is I look at something and I go, oh no, this is going to take me forever. And then I think it won't, because I'm going to set up a quick RetroBatch and drag my 100 files in, and in 30 seconds it's done. So it's a really great app. You know, if you need it, right? If you need to, if I said bass process images and you're like, whoa, that's me, why have you not gotten RetroBatch already? Check it out.
So there's a regular version for $30 and a pro version for $50.
Yeah, that adds a bunch of scripting stuff and really super nerdy stuff if you need that level of control over it. But it's just, I mean, if you think about it, it's a really quick automation for images. If you're somebody who has got a bunch of images that you want to save out in order to put somewhere, and it needs to be a certain size and it needs to be in a certain JPEG format or whatever, like, you add in a couple of nodes really fast and then drag your files in and press go, and it like instantly spits out all of the results. And you can set how they're named and where they go. And like, it really is quite remarkable. It's a great app.
A lot of the back end stuff of Acorn is built into there, I imagine.
Yeah. This is basically Acorn automation happening here.
Yeah. Really cool. Wow. And of course, we've been recommending Acorn for years, maybe decades. Flyingmeat.com. Well, that's it for this episode of Mac Break Weekly. If I might, I'd like to entice you into joining our club. Increasingly, it looks like the best way to do an independent podcast network is to have the listeners support it, and your support is very much appreciated. What do you get? It's not much, $7 a month, actually less than Twitter Blue, and you get a whole lot more. All the shows that we do ad-free. And by the way, shows you don't hear anywhere else are on the Twit Plus feed, like our Hands on Mac. Micah Sargent does that every week. Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott, the Untitled Linux Show, Stacey's Book Club, The Giz Fizz, and more. We launch shows from the club, like This Week in Space, supported by our club members. But I think for many of us, the best part of Club Twit is the exclusive private club in our Discord. I love hanging in the Discord. It's really the best social network you'd ever see. That's part of your membership. So please, if you haven't considered this yet, I think it'd be a great thing to do as a holiday gift for the nerd in your life. Twit.tv/club. Twit.tv/club. There are annual memberships, monthly memberships, and corporate memberships. Plus, all of the shows that we do supported by ads are available ad-free individually for $2.99 a month. All of that is at the website, twit.tv/club or club twit or clubtwit.twit.tv or any permutation thereof. Thank you so much, Andy Iannacco. When are you going to be on GBH next?
Thursday at 12:30. Go to WGBHnews.org to stream it live or later, or go to the WGBH channel on YouTube also to stream it live or later.
Thank you, Andy. We'll see you next week. Alex Lindsay's at officehours.global. That is the place to go if you want to know about, well, pretty much anything. You could participate in their morning Zoom calls. You can see all their stuff after the fact at officehours.global. I want to do this. You were doing the Stream Deck.
Stream Deck.
Yeah.
Whole hour on Stream Deck.
We're just starting to scratch the surface. I didn't realize we could switch the TriCaster with a Stream Deck.
You could
Deck.
Have, see, amazing. And as you can see, you can just stack them up. You can just keep on adding more Stream Decks to the whole thing. So we were some power users talking about Stream Deck and Companion and Central Control and how they all integrate and how to make them work. And yesterday we were talking about, Zoom ISO, so we're really digging into how we a lot of power
getting
users
ready
talking
for
about
Zoom ISO. Yeah,
yeah,
we'll watch that channel, sure.
And then tomorrow we have a Foley artist.
Focus on Foley.
We're going to talk about Foley. It's going to be great. So Greg is amazing, and so I mean he's worked on a lot of feature films, and so he's going to talk about that. And so it's just every day it's something.
I'm going to listen Thursday. Focus on masterful interviewing. That sounds
really good. I don't know. I'll be interested to see what you think. You're pretty good at it.
Well, I have a lot to learn. Nobody, you know, it's hard to, that's a skill that you get better at as you do it. Yeah. Thank you, Alex. And of course, if you want to hire Alex and his team for your next video stream or production or conference, 090.media is the place to go. Jason Snell is the man in charge of Six Colors. Get his color graphs and a whole lot more great Apple coverage, sixcolors.com. He's also a masterful, dare I say, incomparable podcaster.
Oh, I see what you
clever,
did there.
Yeah. Clever, huh?
So, theincomparable.com, a whole network of shows that spun out of the pop culture podcast I do every week. And some more over at relay.fm, too, for tech podcasty sort of stuff. But Six Colors, it's all linked to from sixcolors.com. It's easy to remember. Just go there.
Yeah. Six Colors. I made him make a podcast page.
Yep, he did it.
Sixcolors.com/podcasts because he has so dang many of them.
Yeah, check out Robot or Not this week. John Siracusa and I talked about zombie robot spiders. That was fun.
What is a robot or not?
It's not a robot. Spoiler alert for Robot or Not.
It's not.
An undead zombie spider robot is not a robot. It's just a dead spider being controlled by people.
Well, that's what you say.
And we did a werewolves episode where somebody prompted us who's like an expert on werewolves, apparently, self-appointed. Wow. And the good news is they approved of our episode because that's the scary thing, right? Is they're like, I would like you to rule on whether werewolves are... I think that question was if... Are you a werewolf all the time, or are you only a werewolf when you're a wolf?
And that's a good question.
I forget what we ruled, but we were told
you were correct.
So that was
that's a good question. Not a long show, 5 minutes, but
oh no, it's an anti-podcast. Everything it's like 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Sometimes the theme song is the longest part. it's great fun. It's me and John Siracusa deciding. John, I ask him, and he rules on whether it's, something is something or not.
It's the hors d'oeuvre of podcasts, the amuse-bouche to listen to before you begin your big meal, which is
that's right.
Show.
That's right. I do a lot of 90-minute-long podcasts, and I do one that's 4 minutes long. It's great. Good.
You should have named it amuse-bouche, frankly. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Alex. Thank you all for listening. We do Mac Break Weekly Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. We are going back to standard time on Sunday. So the next time you hear us, we will be at 1900 UTC. You can figure out what that means in your local jurisdiction. I say that so you can watch live or listen live at live.twit.tv, chat live at irc.twit.tv, or in the Club Twit Discord. You can download shows at your own convenience, any old time UTC, from the website, twit.tv/MBW, or YouTube, where we have all the shows in video format. And, of course, probably the easiest thing to do is to get Pocket Casts or Overcast or Apple Podcasts or Google or whatever your favorite podcast client is and subscribe. That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available on a Tuesday evening. Thank you all for being here. Now get back to work because break time is over. Bye-bye.
Hey there, I'm Micah Sargent from Twit. And you may be asking a question. What in the world do you do if you want to thank that hard-working team of yours? Well, why not gift them a Club Twit corporate subscription? Oh, and here's a secret. You'll be benefiting yourself, too, because you will be able to keep your team informed and entertained with podcasts covering the latest in tech, so they'll always stay up to date. With a Club Twit subscription, they're going to get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They'll get access to the members-only Discord server where they can chat with fellow Club Twit members and all of us here at Twit, and exclusive shows like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit and look for corporate plans for complete details.